Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulously fluoridated island-chained paradise in the sunny slave South Pacific, with that Fukushima radiation that's so disastrously fabulous that it's helped the economy, along with giving everybody a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. And my very special guest is none other than Ian Packman from stonesofakron.com. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vinnie.
Would you mind giving us a little bit of a divulgence? Let us know who you are and what it is you do.
Fair enough. I was born in England. I'm a POM, I suppose. But I got fed up with the Maggie Thatcher era of the 1970s and 80s and the IRA and the crap that was going on there, and I used to be in the merchant navy as an engineer, so I used to be coming to New Zealand on a number of occasions and coming to the other side of the world. I just thought what a completely different environment New Zealand was compared to what was happening in England. So after about 10 years I decided I'd emigrate over here, and with the engineering background I got a job at New Plymouth Power Station here, a big thermal power station, and started work there. But then engineering was never my it wasn't something I always wanted to do. It was something I fell into because it was a way of getting a job and getting started in life. But I always wanted to write. I was always a great reader of books and researcher, and so a few years ago I said to my wife, I would like to write a book. And the problem was that being at sea at the time, you get very tired, and you just simply can't write and do the job at sea. So it was a question of, do I write and leave the sea, or do I stay at sea and never follow the dream of writing? So she read a bit of the works that I had done, and she said, give up the sea and start writing. So from sort of 2004 up to 2009, I wrote a trilogy called Stones of Akron, a sci-fi fantasy trilogy for all ages. And then we had a problem with getting it published. We tried several publishing houses, but it's basically impossible. So we decided to self-publish, and we approached a guy here in Plymouth, and they said, yep, not a problem. And within a few months, we had the books published, and then we started hitting the road and selling them. And they proved to be very successful, I'm very thankful to say. The public, after a few months, there was a bit of a downtime there while they were reading. The emails coming back and the phone calls was that they thoroughly enjoyed them. So I actually completed the trilogy and the publishing of it, because we only published book one to begin with. We'll see how it goes. And then the feedback was, where on earth is book two? We want it now. So we had to work extremely hard and fast to get book two ready. And then, of course, book three was a foregone conclusion. The story is across three books. It isn't three separate books. It's one story across three books. So it was cunning plan.
Ian, you might want to sit a little closer to your microphone there. You're kind of a bit distant.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a heck of a lot better there. Right. Well, so what's involved in writing a trilogy? I mean, have you had any challenges to your personal constitution or something in the process of this?
It's a huge challenge to the brain. A trilogy is a big book to write, especially I wrote it with time travel involved, and I had well over 100 characters in the books. The main characters, there are two groups of teenagers and a few adults scattered around. So the big problem for me was just actually keeping track of it all and keeping track of the story I was writing, especially with the time travel, because it book two just about defeated me, because I'd written myself into a corner where I'd had people scattered all over the universe at different times in the future, in the past, the present, and I had to bring them all back together, and that really proved a major problem, because I was stuck with it. So my wife and I actually went up to Turangi for a weekend, and we just brainstormed the whole thing to try and figure it out, and we did, and came back and sorted it all out. So it was a lot of mental work. There were several years involved in writing the three books. But it worked. So you know, the satisfaction was that what was just a fantasy in my head actually turned out to be a pretty good story, which people have really, really enjoyed.
Yeah. Have you ever found the problem with fiction is that you have to make it make sense?
That is a major thing, especially with science fiction. You're dealing with facts. You're dealing with time travel as we know it on a scientific level. So you have to be very careful about what you do. You can't put it into the realms of just pure stupidity. It has to be acceptable. And the public at large, especially the scientific science fiction public, they're pretty intelligent people, and they, you know, they've studied Star Trek and all the rest of the sci-fi and television stuff and the books, the Isaac Asimov and all the rest of it. So they're pretty discerning, and if you start bullshitting them, they'll just switch off. So it was important for me to think very carefully about what I was doing. If I introduced anything, I had to think very careful. Is this practicable? Is it understandable? Will it be accepted? And every time I approached something like that, that was very much on the back of my mind. I was very aware that there are going to be critics out there, and they're going to tear it to pieces. So I got my endorsement from a gentleman here in New Plymouth who was an astrologer, and he read the book, and read the first book, and then was demanding book two and book three. And he said, no, you've got everything correct. He couldn't find any fault in it. And so from having that endorsement from somebody that knows space and stars and moons and all the rest of it, that was pretty pleasing. I was pretty worried about that.
I watched this film called North Country, and in the making of it, one of the producers said, what a film's synopsis is really supposed to be like is, first of all, what's the film about? Second of all, what it's really about, and third of all, what it's really, really about.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty in-depth answer.
Well, I'd like to hear the in-depth answer from you. So, you know, I don't know if that's even possible. I mean, you know, don't want to put you on the spot here, but
it is. I did, when I was travelling around the country talking to people at craft fairs and things, and they were asking me, you know, what's the book about? And, of course, the first answer is that it's an adventure story, basically, sci-fi, fantasy, based on factual places. So there is the basic beginnings of the book. It's just basically an adventure story. But it's also a book that teaches young people. I'm very much sort of old school in terms of a book should be there for entertainment and education. And there are different levels of education, of course. So that there is that side of the book. So I was anticipating young people reading it, and I was teaching them, as I was telling them the story, I was teaching them about people, societies, and the weather, geology, mountains, space travel, all sorts of things, mystery, magic. And then, of course, there is another level to it, which is, it touches, for the older readers, it touches on the political in terms of the madness that we have in our world, and really the madness of the human being, really. It's too easy to say the madness that we have in the world today. It's really focusing on the stupidity of people that we have in our society. And then there's another level on top of that, which is, it all depends on who you are and what you want to see in the book, but there is a spiritual level in the book, and that is one that is very much focused on the individual. I don't talk about it as such. What I do is I use the subject as part of the story. So it's up to the individual to see it. And there's no point in ramming it down a 12-year-old. You have to take into account the wisdom and maturity of the reader. So the books do have a multi-level understanding. And that, I was wondering when I wrote it whether or not it would work. And it did, to an amazing degree, because after 3 years of selling and all the feedback that we've got, I had an email from a lady who told me that her 10-year-old son had read books 1 and 2, and at the end of book 2 said to his mother that he thought his world had come to an end. And the problem then was that I was still desperately trying to get book 3 published. And my oldest reader was a gentleman in Napier that I met at a craft show. He was 91 years old. He was an ex-Spitfire pilot from the Second World War. And he bought the first 2 books, as though book 3 wasn't published. And he read both books in 2 weeks. And then he emailed me and said he thoroughly enjoyed them and couldn't wait for book 3. So to write a trilogy, basically, where you can say you've got a reading age group from 10 to 90, male and female, I would say that I've actually succeeded in the different levels that I introduced in the book. So the 10-year-old would see the level that he sees, and the 90-year-old would see all of the levels, because with the wealth of experience and wisdom that man had, it was quite heartwarming to have his comments, and he enjoyed the books. Over to you.
Over to me, of course, indeed. The other element here is, as well, if you're trying to, I think when I wrote a play and put it on, I think the measure of what I wanted to get across was a physical reaction out of the audience. Like, I wanted to make them cry.
Right.
And I did.
Right.
And I thought that that's basically part of the most powerful thing that you can do with a work of fiction, is to produce a real reaction.
Yes, yes. And that's what I was looking for in the readers, because every time I sold a book to the customer, I would demand from them that they get in touch with me and email me or phone me or whatever, and just give me their appreciation of the story, good or bad. And a lot of them did. And I was quite overwhelmed at the response that I got. And of course, I was looking for particular answers to questions. And from one lady in particular, I knew from her character, I knew that there would be a chapter in book 1 that would affect her. And I knew it did, because she never mentioned it. And it was a very powerful scene, and it would bring tears to your eyes. She talked about everything else, but she wouldn't talk about that chapter. So it was there, and I had other comments later on from people about certain chapters, about the humour in it. So I was very pleased. It's actually quite difficult, I found, to get the humour, because people's ability to laugh at things is incredibly varied. And that reflects in the soap operas and the dramas and the comedians that we have today. So I was quite pleased that some people actually said they liked the humour in the book, and you get those that would be in tears. And the very last book, the third book, there is a sad bit at the end, but I sort of interspersed it with some happiness. And one lady, I sent the book to her as soon as it was off the press, and she read it in a few days and emailed me, and she said her words were, it was a shame that we had to lose some of the characters and some of the people, but she understood, and she then mentioned one scene right at the end of the book, and she said if it was ever made into a film, there wouldn't be a dry eye in the auditorium. So that was deliberately done, and it worked with her, so clearly the success of it is in the response. And it is a very satisfying thing, as you will have found, if you write a play and you will get a direct answer straight away from the reaction of your audience in the play. But when you write a book, it's actually quite hard to get that feedback from people. Sometimes you actually have to dig it out of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because they're not there, and I think maybe reading a book is more of a private thing, you know, like you can't be talking and having a conversation with somebody while you're reading.
No, and when you read a book, you go off into your own dream world with a book, because you become absorbed in the story, and this is what happens, you know, people pick up a book and they start reading it, and when they enjoy it, you know, they're off in fairyland, they're off living the scene and the characters and everything else, and very much the Charles Dickens or Around the World in 80 Days and Jules Verne and all that. You actually live the experiences. So it is hard. These people, this is why one of the things that I found when writing and having characters in a book, it's a mistake to over-describe characters, because it doesn't matter how much description you give. The reader will implant in their own conscience how that person speaks, how they look, you know, what colour their hair is and all this. And I found that out with one of the characters. I didn't specifically say certain things about the character, but I implied it. And when I asked people months later, every one of the descriptions of this girl was different. So it's a waste of time actually describing people in a book too much, because people will create their own character in their own mind.
Well, isn't that interesting? Maybe that's like part of why soap operas are so successful, is because people see themselves in the characters.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I had a discussion with somebody just recently, because if you go onto the UK channel on Sky, number 13, where they show all of these old English comedy program things, but they also show Dallas. Now, Dallas came on at a time in my life when I was away at sea for a great length of time, and I would be coming back from sea, and everybody you meet was talking about Dallas and the character, and I couldn't understand this overwhelming belief in the characters of these people. And I never saw, I probably saw bits of episodes and bits of programs, but no sooner had I seen one or two than I was away at sea again, so the whole thing was a complete mystery to me. But I actually watched a few of the programs just a few months ago, because they came back on the television, and I was actually quite shocked, because the characters are, they're well acted, but they're awful people, and people, the actors actually, like J.R. Ewing and all the rest of it, they played them extremely well. And I think that it was so appreciated by people is that because they actually identified with these people. And it was actually quite shocking to see that there were such scumbags in the world, and people truly identified with them, so much so that they loved the program. It was a real eye-opener to me. Very, very realistic. I can understand why people then took to Dallas and why they loved it, because it was so realistic to the daily lives that we live today and the people that you meet and have to work with.
It's kind of creepy, though, isn't it?
It's disturbing.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm starting to wonder about evolution. I'm starting to think it's more like devolution. Like, things don't get better, they just get freaking worse.
I would agree with you. I don't think, I think we're still, the mentality of people today and our world leaders and everything that's going on is as medieval as it could be. I think if you turn the clock back 500, 800 years to England and France and Germany, you'd find exactly the same people doing exactly the same things. We do it faster, we do it quicker, we have better weapons and all the rest of it. But the reality is our society is just as medieval, just as vicious, just as psychopathic as it was 500, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. We haven't actually changed or learned anything in society, absolutely nothing.
Incidentally, we've still got a royal family. Several hundred years ago. And the working week used to be, I think there was some kind of study released about how many times you'd spend at work and that kind of thing. Apparently, yep. Back in the day, even during serfdom, you had to work less hours a week than we do today, and you've got higher quality produce that even the local lords and what have you would eat, you know?
Yeah.
It's almost like we're worse slaves today than we were back then. They've just convinced us that we're free.
Well, I think we are worse, because I think in the old days you would have the housewife, the farmer's wife at home preparing food and doing the washing and all the rest of it. And there would be the one worker in the house, the farmer, the father, and he would be off work. Well, now it's almost compulsory that we have both parents working and the children are put into some little crèche somewhere. So, you know, you don't even get the family spirit and the family communication that would have been so intense in those days. So not only are we working twice as hard, we're actually destroying our family units and our families left, right and centre. And I'm pretty sure that 500 years ago, teenagers didn't get blasted out of their brains on pot and dope and LSD, but they do now, because there is nothing left in their lives to look forward to. I think a lot of suicide cases, which are never discussed in this country, and if you actually talk to these people and find out why they committed suicide, it's basically a lack of self-esteem, lack of respect, but also a lack of, or a very good understanding of just what a rotten picture they're living. And they can't see their way out of it, so they kill themselves. Mm. And it's an absolute tragedy.
Yeah. Same with the prescription drug suicides. I think they've reached a record in the United States. Like, I think more deaths, yep. unnatural deaths in America caused by suicide than anything else.
Yeah, I would fully understand that. I travelled through the States with my wife a few years ago, and I was actually quite shocked. I went over there as a lifetime ambition to go and see America and see the things that I used to read about and dream about. And we did a 10-week tour. We did 24,000 kilometres. We visited about 34 states, I think. And did the usual things of visiting Niagara Falls, Death Valley, Yosemite National Park. We saw the Space Shuttle Atlantis take off. We went to Tombstone. We did all the usual sightseeing things, Grand Canyon. And I didn't go over there with any political intent at all, but halfway around the country, I became aware that there was something wrong with the country. It felt wrong. And we started talking to people, and they were only too pleased to talk to us. It was almost as though these people had never talked to anybody in their lives. And we were talking about New Zealand and the world, and we became aware of just how isolated their knowledge of the world is. But they genuinely seemed lost. And sometimes it was actually very difficult to get on with our journey, because these people wouldn't let us go. They wanted to keep on talking to us. And on our final day before we flew out, we were at a motel, and we were talking to a guy, and we were talking to him for about 3 hours. He was buying us whiskies and wines all evening. And at the end of it, it was late in the evening. He finally stood up and he said, look, Ian, he says, I've got to go, but I just want to thank you. He says, that's the best conversation I've had in 5 years. And I thought, well, how lovely was that, but also how tragic. Because if I'm a visitor to his country and I'm the only thing that he's talked to for 5 years, there's something very wrong with the country.
It's like fear, or, you know what it is? Constant freaking distraction. the least educated, the most well-entertained population on Earth.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They are absolutely focused on television. If you go to a Best Western, you go into the breakfast room in the morning and there's two or three televisions all hanging from the ceiling and all that. And nobody's talking to each other. They're all focused on these drama people on television who pretend to be newsreaders. And all these people are just staring with just totally blank faces at these television screens. And there's no conversation going on, absolutely nothing. If you actually say hello to some people that are early in the morning like that, they look actually quite shocked. It is actually quite terrible, which is why we kept away from all the cities. We drove around the backwoods, and unfortunately we had to go on a lot of freeways and all that, interstates, because it was the only way to get around the country in the time we had available. But we avoided the cities because it's just... apart from one place, we drove through a place called St. Joseph's, a city right in the Midwest there, on the borders of Kansas and Missouri, I think, I don't remember. And there was nothing there. There were tumbleweeds going down the streets. There were these beautiful, beautiful Victorian, Georgian buildings with plywood in the windows. The place, I'd heard of ghost towns in America, but this was a ghost city. It was just dust and dead. And we filled up with petrol. We finally found a petrol station. We filled up with petrol, crossed the river, and went into Kansas. And we stopped at a place called Maryville that evening and got chatting to a couple who owned a farm outside Maryville, and they invited us down for a meal that evening. And once again, it was actually harder to get away from these people because it wasn't until about midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning that we could actually pull ourselves away from them because they just wouldn't stop talking. But I asked them about St. Joseph's. I said, you know, what's happened with that city? And the old man, he was about 75, 78, and he said, he says the corporations decided that the city wasn't worth it anymore, so they moved the big businesses out of it 100 or 200 miles, and the city has collapsed. And I believe that's the sort of thing that's going on all over the place. You know, places like Detroit, once the businesses have finished with it, they just move out and they collapse. Everything just collapses.
Something tells me there's somebody making a lot of money on the back burner with these kind of deals, you know? Imagine you can just destroy the real estate of a city and then come in and buy that puppy up for pennies on the dollar.
Yeah, it's a few years. It has to be a few years later, you know, when everything just goes downhill and people move out, then the land, you buy the land up for nothing and then build your city back up again and make vast profits out of it. But the human catastrophe of the families and the communities that are destroyed is absolutely incredible. And it really, and this is what I was saying about driving around America at the time, is that you just got this feeling that something was desperately wrong with the country. And this is what we saw. And by the time we had done 8 weeks, you know, it was apparent that it wasn't just one state or one area. This was right across America. If we had just gone to, say, Kansas or Missouri or Tennessee and seen it, you know, because people could have said, oh, well, you know, you didn't do enough traveling because it wouldn't have been like that somewhere else. Well, it actually was like that, and it was like that everywhere. The only area of the United States that we didn't travel to, and we basically, because we ran out of time, was the northeastern corner, the Jersey, New Hampshire, Washington, New York. So most of the states are missing on our list were over in that corner because we just didn't have enough time. And it was my thought that, okay, we can easily lop off that little area and come back another time and just spend 6-7 weeks in that one area. And so we did the rest of America. And the rest of America is really going through some hard times.
Had you been to America before and come back and seen a difference, or had this?
Oh, for sure. When I went to sea for the first time, I joined a few ships, one in New Orleans, one in Houston, and I'd flown through the airports before, and the America that I knew back in the 1970s was exactly the sort of America that you would have seen with John Wayne and all the Hollywood stars of the 50s, 60s and 70s. It was exactly what they portrayed it to be. And the food was fantastic, and the orange juice, you know, just bled out of water coolers everywhere. And
the breakfasts were so large you couldn't eat them and that sort of thing. And I told my wife Raymond, I said, look, you know, when we get over there, we're going to find out, you're going to find all this fantastic food and all the rest of it. Well, the food was just awful. The change in America from the 1970s, early 80s is almost indescribable. It is a country that has fallen apart. It's disintegrated. There were sometimes we had meals there in some of these motels. I wouldn't have fed them to a dog. The food was just absolutely terrible. And that was, again, it was something that we noticed right across America. If you wanted a really good meal, or you wanted a meal that you could eat, you actually had to go to an expensive restaurant. But down at the grassroots level, it was, Denny's and McDonald's and even KFC. We went to Kentucky and went to the Mammoth Caves there. And there was a KFC place there, and we thought, come on, you know, we'll have to have KFC in Kentucky. And it was awful. I couldn't believe just how awful it was. It was just something you had to go there and experience to actually understand it. It's not something you can explain easily to people. You have to go there and experience it and realize just how bad it is.
Yeah, like Iraq.
Yeah. I've never been to Iraq and I've never been to Afghanistan, but I've talked to people here in New Zealand who have been to Iraq and Afghanistan, and they come back and they say the Iraqis and the Afghan people are wonderful people. The problems that they have over there have been caused by Western influence and everything else. If they had only just been left alone, you know, granted they had certain problems, you know, with Saddam Hussein and all this, but the countries, the people are good people. But the politics that come along and destroy these things is quite revealing. And it's the same all over the world, of course. Some of the countries we've been to, and I've been to quite a few countries. The people, I have never been to a country yet that I haven't liked the people. But when you get up to the political systems and the legal systems, you realize just where all the troubles are, and the very rich, very wealthy people that control everything and destroy so much. It's unbelievable.
Well, they don't really have anything, no responsibilities. Is that about the size of it? Because I've had a look all my life at people in power, people with riches and things of this nature, and it doesn't matter whether they're a great person or a wonderfully kind person, there's always something bad about them that surfaces, you know?
And you wonder,
how is it that people can't get into power and influence, like real power and influence, long-lasting power and influence, without being bought off and corrupted in some way, shape or form, or blackmailed in order to do the wrong thing?
I think it's a good question, and I have thought about it a few times, and I haven't thought about it too in-depth into that. But you often see good people going into politics, and within a few years they get destroyed. I think a system is just so immovable. To give you an example here, in 2006, I came across a problem in the legal system here in New Plymouth. And it wasn't my problem, so I couldn't really interfere with it. But after about a year, I could no longer stand back and watch this person getting ripped off. So I started to ask questions, and I started to get myself involved in it. And the funny thing was that I started talking to the solicitors and the lawyers involved, and I found that I wasn't able to communicate with them. So my first reaction was, okay, these are highly intelligent, you know, highly educated people who deal in law. I mean, the fundamental rock bottom foundation of society is law and rules governing our society. So these people are at the very heart of our society and our communities. So I thought, well, they're educated people, so it must be me. It has to be me. So I began to think, okay, well, why am I not communicating with these people? What am I not understanding? So I started doing a bit of reading, and I got hold of a book by a professor of law at Canterbury University called Duncan Webb. And I read this book. And at the end of it, well, to be absolutely frank, after every chapter or two, I actually had to put the book down and go outside into the garden and sit amongst the roses to stop myself from being physically sick. Because the book was quite revealing. It actually revealed the very mindset of these people. They are very, very sick, uneducated, intellectually retarded people. And then it all came clear to me why I couldn't talk to these people, because they actually didn't understand what I was saying. And that was a huge revelation. To actually sit in the room with a lawyer and a solicitor and realize, when you look into these people's eyes, that they actually don't understand what you're saying. And these people are so superior and so conceited, so powerful in their knowledge that they can control people and abuse people, that if you actually try and talk to them at the level of humanity and common decency and ethics, they don't understand it. And this is where I think the problem lies, because it is such an awful system that if you go into it and try and change it, you end up killing yourself. And so you get out. And traveling around the country, because I wrote a book about it, and I self-published it and started distributing it all around the country, and I sent out about 700 copies around the country, I had an awful lot of people come to me when I was selling my book, Stone to Dacon, and telling me of their experiences with lawyers and solicitors around the country. And they all faced exactly the same problem. They couldn't talk to these people. They simply didn't understand what they were saying. But I also came across lawyers and solicitors who told me quite frankly and quite outright that they had once been a lawyer and a solicitor, but they could no longer stand the system, and so they resigned and got out. And this is what happens, and it happens in politics. You get these people that go in with the best of intentions, and they're reasonably educated, but they go in there and they're up against a system so solid and so filthy that it actually destroys their will to continue the fight. And you have to be very, very hard-skinned to survive in that world of insanity, because this is how these people live. They simply cannot see what they're doing is wrong. They believe in it so much. And they reinforce their beliefs by talking to people of similar ilk. So in their whole lives, from the times that they leave school, from kindergarten onwards, these people are indoctrinated. It's rammed into them. And because they live in a world where they're surrounded by like people, they simply do not understand that there is another world, a different world, and it's a better world. So they continue doing what they're doing, and they reinforce each other left, right, and center. It is an amazing thing. And to give you a clear example of the power of that is that even though I wrote this book and sent it all around the country, not a single lawyer has contacted me over it. No solicitor, no lawyer. They can't do it. They do not know how to talk. So this is what you're up against. In trying to change a system that is so corrupt and so filthy, you first have to be able to communicate with these people, and that's just simply not possible. They don't understand.
They don't have humanity.
No, there's no humanity there at all. They are vacuums. They are absolutely inert.
Yeah, they do. They've sold humanity for a huge amount of money.
Correct. It's all about money. I worked it out. I thought, you know how many lawyers and solicitors there are in this country? There's, I thought it was over 10,000. It's actually, the last figure I saw was over 11,000. So if you work it out, then each one of these lawyers and solicitors must make, per annum, individually, at least $100,000. That means that the income to the New Zealand Law Society per year is over $1 billion. That's how much money comes out of society to do with law and the manipulation of law. And that's a minimum figure. It has to be a lot higher. Mm. And of course,
I notice how you put the extra qualifier and the manipulation of law, because ultimately the application is virtually the manipulation in and of itself nowadays.
Oh, absolutely. That's what the law is about these days. It has nothing to do with justice. They never talk about justice. If you ever hear a judge talking about the law in the courts, then all judges always explain to the applicants and the criminals that this is a court of law. They never say it's a court of justice. It's a court of law. So whenever some nasty little decisions are being made, it's all done because of the law, not because of justice. But when you go to the justice minister, he's not a law minister. They call him a justice minister because it gives the illusion that he's there to provide justice. And he's not. The justice minister is basically a waste of time. I approached one justice minister once to try and solve this problem that I had, and he was unable to do a thing. He had absolutely no responsibility towards justice or the law in this country whatsoever. The entire thing is an illusion. So, and I found this right from the very bottom right to the very top. There is nobody responsible for justice in this country. You get one or two people who are responsible for law, and the law, of course, can be manipulated to suit the system. And it's worth an incredible amount of money, absolutely vast amount of money. And the government, of course, you know, for every dollar the lawyers make, the government will take almost 50% of it in tax. So to go to the government and say, you know, you need to have justice here is a waste of time, because if they have justice in this country, the income that the government gets out of the law society would be halved. So the government is never going to do anything about justice in this country. It's worth far too much money. So,
think about it. I mean, how many times has a mafia don or something like that gone, you know what? Heroin's too profitable. Let's sell weed instead.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's where the money is. Like, I can't remember if it was the Godfather or I can't remember at all now, but I remember seeing a documentary or program or a film to do with the mafia. And they had a kind of code of honor that they used to have, if you could have a code of honor in the criminal organization. But they never dealt with drugs. And then in the United States, drugs were introduced. And they realized that the profits to be had with drugs were so huge that they actually couldn't ignore it. So apart from the usual extortion and rape and murder and prostitution and all the rest of it, they then went to drugs. But apparently there were quite a number of the old mafia people who initially said, no, they won't touch it. It's against morality and ethics and humanity to destroy people with drugs. But again, the profits were just so massive that they were squeezed out, and the arsehole took over, and then you've got drugs everywhere. And in the old days, it was just the alcohol and the tobacco. And the tobacco was never a big problem until they started introducing cigarettes at the beginning of the last century. And the alcohol has always been controlled by society and communities and people. But nobody can control drugs. And so the drugs are the most profitable and the most destructive thing that are around. And it's all done because...
I'm not sure if nobody can control drugs. The CIA seems to be doing a fine job.
In what way?
In growing and distributing
it. Oh, they're doing a fantastic job. Yeah,
it was a record it was a record last quarter, you know.
Yeah, this is one of the things. Well, you see, this is one of the things that nobody ever really... This is one of the things that I can never understand on the news media. They give you all the information about what America is doing, what the CIA is doing, what the military is doing, and all the rest of it, but nobody ever does anything about it, you know. And they said that the Taliban were knocking out the drugs in Afghanistan, and they were doing a very good job on it. And then, of course, the Americans went in, and of course, they had a record year for producing drugs then, because that's what the Americans are allowing to happen. But that's the problem all over the world, and it's a corporate thing. It's because people don't naturally gravitate to drugs and alcohol and all the rest of it. This is forced upon them by the system.
Oh, but then again, drugs have been used in many, many cultures throughout time for a long period of time. I think it's one of the oldest traditions ever.
Well, the original thing would have been drugs to alleviate pain and all the rest of it. I mean, the opium thing... was a British-sponsored catastrophe in China. The Chinese didn't have opium until the British introduced it into China. And again, the profits were astronomical. So, and the Chinese, actually, the Chinese government, whoever was in charge at the time, they tried extremely hard to stop it happening. But then the British came in with their gunboats and their soldiers and started shooting people, and eventually they overturned the local law, and opium was then flooded into China. And of course, this is the perception that we have now, is of the Chinese sucking on these opium pipes. But that was never part of their culture. That was forced onto them by the British. who quite conveniently don't want to talk about that anymore. But this is, and again, it's the same thing with the heroin and the cannabis and all the rest of it. People in South America, when they were using the drug, but they were using it as part of a local thing that they understood. They knew how to use it, they knew the problems with it, and they didn't abuse it like it's being done today, because the drugs today are recreational drugs. Drugs in the past were never recreational, but now they've been called a recreational drug. It's just another way of covering up how nice and good they are. Mm.
Also to say that all the other drugs that they're giving you are medicinal, when in actual fact most of them are probably 10 times more likely to kill you than any illicit drug.
Well, that's it, and there's no trust and faith in it anymore, and you know, you've got to be really careful now about what's being touted out there. In the past, you know, if they said they had a drug that would help combat TB and all this, the penicillin and all these sort of things, this is exactly what they were. They were drugs that actually helped you survive and kick out these drugs. But now there's so much on the market, and they're there for profit. They're not there for your good and your the benefit of mankind.
If they cured you, they put themselves out of business. So here's a question, economically, are they going to try and cure you? Really? Really? Is the doctor actually going to give you the advice? Or is he going to take the perks that he's offered and take that trip to Tahiti that he's always been dreaming about?
Yeah, and this is the problem, is it? And it started off in the United States, of course, with doctors endorsing certain drugs because they were paid to do so. And people, you see, this is where the level of trust in the world has completely obliterated us, in that people in the past used to trust. You used to trust your doctors. You used to trust the World Health Organization. You used to trust the medical authorities in each country. But now each one of these places and each one of these authorities, they're all on the bandwagon now as well, you know, and we have all these flu vaccines that we're supposed to be taking to stop these epidemics. You know, 10 years ago, at the beginning of the new millennium, every single year we had a new pandemic flu that was going to wipe out the planet. You know, we had swine flu, we had bird flu, we had SARS, and every year it was a different one. And it was all panic and it was all fear, and everyone rushed down and bought all these drugs and these Panadols and everything else and Tamiflu. And of course, nobody really died. You know, no, the people that died would have probably died anyway, because that's the nature of the human race. You get diseases. Sometimes you fight them and win, and sometimes you don't. But all of a sudden, if it was all about buy this, buy that to combat this deadly thing that was going to kill everybody. Well, of course, we're still here today. You know, there's no epidemics, no pandemics, nothing. It's just it's all in the media, it's all in the politics, it's all in the media, and all in the corporations and the profits.
Yeah.
And people believe it. This is what gets me, is that people suck it up like a flipping great big vacuum cleaner. You know, they suck up all this shit and just fill themselves up with dirt, and you can't talk to people. I've tried it. I give up now. And if people want to go out and buy $500 worth of drugs to combat flu, as far as I'm concerned, they can do it. You know, there's a waste of time telling them, because they just won't listen. This is how much we've been conditioned in our world. We are programmed completely. It's unbelievable.
Been conditioned almost as much as our brains have been washed. You know what I'm saying? In the shampooing sense of the word.
Now, you're not going to tell me that the shampoo has been conditioning our brains, have you?
Well, in actual fact, some shampoos have been found to turn you into a zombie, you know?
You didn't read too many sci-fi books.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, where do you think the people who write the sci-fi books get their ideas from? Reality.
I believe you. I think, you know, when you go back to the 1960s and 70s with Star Trek and all that, all the writers of it, you know, they used to consult with NASA and astronomers and astrologers and all the rest of it, and everything that they did was based on actual research, because like I said earlier on, if you're writing a book or a play or anything like that, you have to have a high degree of credibility in it. So Star Trek, for all of its drama and everything, was actually based on research and the credibility of the science. So, you know, there's always a modicum of fact in everything that's going on, but we're living in a world now where fact and truth have been turned into dirty words, you know, and we have conspiracy theorists and all the rest of it. And now what you've got to do is mention a conspiracy and everybody switches off because they've been programmed to believe that what was true has now become a conspiracy. And so you labelled it as a conspiracy. So people, although they're hearing the truth, they don't realise it's the truth because they've already switched off to it because somebody else labelled it a conspiracy.
It's quite convenient, you know. You can win any argument.
You can win any argument. I give up with a lot of people because you try and tell them some things and their eyes glaze over and they just don't want to go there, you know. They just don't want to think about it. They just can't. They've been brainwashed. It's a frightening thing, and this is what I found in America. It's an absolutely frightening thing, and this is why it's so easy to get into a conversation over there, and you can't leave because these people. I don't think a lot of Americans actually talk to each other. You know, they listen to the soap operas and they listen to Fox Television and CNN and George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and they just believe absolutely everything that's being told them. It's a tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy what's happening in America.
One does have to feel sorry for them to a degree, don't you? Or did they all just bring it on themselves?
I feel sorry for them. I feel desperately sorry for them because I grew up surrounded by Americans. When I was a kid, my father was in the Royal Air Force in England, and we went out to France in the early 60s when... NATO and the Americans and the British were still having bases over in France, and De Gaulle came along and he kicked everybody out, but I was over there at the time when we could be over there. We were stationed just outside Paris, and everywhere was Americans, absolutely everywhere. I mean, they were just overwhelming. We were on an American base and they're American people. We went to an American cinema, and generous to a fault, the Americans. Especially if you're a 5-year-old, 6-year-old kid, you know, they give you chocolate bars and boxes of popcorn and magazines, you know, and comic books and all the rest of it. You just get, and these are the sort of things in those days that you didn't normally see because you couldn't afford it, and the British didn't have it, and this sort of thing. So, the view of Americans at the time, you couldn't fault them. And I've always held that belief because as I grew older and I started reading about America in the Second World War and what the American soldiers did, what they had to put up with, and the generosity of American soldiers all around the world, the airmen and the Navy, you know, it was just absolutely, you simply couldn't fault them. And they were very erratic in which way they fired their guns. You know, there was an excellent chance that you might get shot by one of them yourself. But they apologised afterwards. But no, they were desperately good people. But I think they've been brainwashed. They've been programmed by television. Television over in America is the god. And if every single channel out of the hundreds of channels over there, if they're all talking the same shit, there is simply nobody left to talk to. And I think that's part of the big psychology of it. And that's the way they're controlled. They're just controlled because they don't know who to turn to. And if you've got 250-odd million people all being controlled like that, it's like I said with the lawyers, how do you go and talk to these people? Because you go and talk to them and they'll talk to you because you're an outsider, but they won't talk to each other because they don't know what to talk about. And they don't, you know, because... And of course, they have all their own individual problems over there, in that you have Republicans and you have the Democrats and you have the Jews and you have the Christians and you have the Hindus and the Muslims and the gays, you know, and everything becomes magnified over there. It's like looking at everything through a magnifying glass. You start off with a small problem and all of a sudden it's just overwhelming. And the media gets hold of it and blows it up and everybody becomes focused on it, and nobody can think anymore. And everybody has to have an opinion because you're in a free country, so you're allowed to have your own opinion. And everybody's got a gun, so you're allowed to express your opinion. But the funny thing was that when I was over there, I never saw anybody with guns. I think I saw in the whole 10 weeks, we saw about 5 police cars right across America. It was unbelievable how few police cars there were. When I drove from Auckland to New Plymouth, when we came back, I saw 6 just in the drive back. But in the whole of the States, we only saw about 5 police cars. And so, you know, they live in a world of illusions. And they don't know what the truth is anymore.
I guess the same is to a degree very true of us all. I mean, I get interviewed by Americans all the time, and vice versa. And some of the questions I get is, how's New Zealand? Is it different from what we're doing? And I say, well, take everything that's going on in your country right now, you know, the corrupt politicians, the financial scumbaggery, the progressive legislation to curtail your rights, the meaningless checkpoints, and the general New World Order type scumbaggery, and you just apply it over here, and they're like, oh, so you guys have got fluoride? Yeah, we've got fluoride. Oh, you guys have got toxic vaccines? Yeah, we've got toxic vaccines. Oh, you guys have got mercury-filled energy-saving light bulbs that you're trying to ban the alternatives to? Yeah, we've got that one. Yeah. Oh, you guys have got, like, progressive food legislation that's going to wind up making it illegal to basically grow your own veggies or collect rainwater or anything. Yeah, bro, absolutely.
Yep, I absolutely agree with you. I arrived in New Zealand in 1983, and this country now today is unrecognisable to what it was 30 years ago. It's changed completely. And we are following the American way, because our politicians, Helen Clark and John Key and Jim Bolger and Jenny Shipley, are all, they've got the American flag actually stamped on their hearts and their brains. And all of them are friendly with Americans. And so we follow the American policy. So, yes, there's no surprise to me that what's happening in this country with the genetically modified food, fluoridation, and the corporatization of absolutely every asset that New Zealand has is following the American dream. Well, New Zealand is no longer a country. It's no longer an identity. This country has a massive identity crisis, because people think they're in New Zealand, but they're actually following the corporate America. And we follow America, full stop, end of story. There's no argument anymore. And everything that we see, we watch American programs on television, American products that are pushed on us. Everything is American. And the law and the politics and the corporations and everything follows American ideals. And there's nothing, and New Zealanders accept it. This is why, of course, during Helen Clark's reign, 500,000 New Zealanders buggered off to Australia. And, I mean, it was an absolutely catastrophic flood of New Zealanders, but they were doing the right thing. They're going to a country where they can still talk, they can still think, they earn higher wages, the quality of life is much better. It's a tougher existence over there, of course, but people enjoy that. They enjoy working in a community where everybody pulls together and everybody talks to each other. And 500,000 New Zealanders, it's a flood, it's a biblical flood. And the government...
I was going to use the word exodus.
Well, it is, isn't it? It is. This is a country with just over 4 million people. And 500,000 New Zealanders in the space of 10 years left this country. And they're not coming back, and despite what John Key and all the rest of it are saying. These people are not coming back. You'll get a couple come back, you know, for family reasons or ties or whatever, but they ain't coming back, because I mean, if 500,000 people came back, they'd all be unemployed, so there's nothing to come back for. And you know, once the children start growing over there, they ain't going to come back to this funny country in New Zealand, you know, not when they've got the magnificent beaches and the sunshine and the entertainment and the jobs, the vast variety of jobs and careers that are available to them over there. But, of course, the government here just sits back and says, no, it's not a problem. And Helen Clark said, she even admitted, she was asked, you know, do you see there's a problem with all the young people just pouring over there? And she said, no, they're just a drain on the economy here, you know, send them over to Australia. So, you know, as a...
what she means is, oh, we'll just pour on more immigrants.
Well, this is it. And, you see, once you bring in the immigrants, you don't have to pay them as much. You can... they don't speak English too well. They can't fight the system. They don't get paid, you know, and what are they going to do? So, you know, the corporations take huge advantage of this. But they're just being brought over as slaves. They just don't realize it. But, you know, when you look at the countries that they're coming from, they're quite pleased to come over to a country like this, where they can get the medical benefits and the education benefits for their children, which they couldn't get in their own country. But of course, as they start to get older and they start to grow up and they start to learn and they speak English, they begin to realize that the white man down the road is actually being paid more than they are, and they're doing the same job. So up in Auckland, of course, they're having huge problems. I went up there 2 years ago, 3 years ago, with my wife when we were selling our books. And we went round to all the high schools in Auckland. And that was actually quite a revelation. Auckland's not a communal city or a community. It's actually a series of ghettos. You've got a Chinese ghetto, you've got an Indian ghetto, you've got a Maori ghetto, you've got an islander ghetto, you've got the rich whites ghettos, you've got the poor white ghettos, and it's not a community, it's not a city, it's a region of reservations where you import all these Chinese and Indians and Somalis and this, and you put them on the reservations. But they don't call them reservations, you know, they just, it's Auckland. It was actually quite...
Because in Auckland you don't need a reservation.
Have you been talking to Len Brown?
Well, actually, I did lead the Len Brown stand down protest.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that when you had that megaphone? Or?
Well, yeah. That's one of the times.
And how are Aucklanders dealing with it? Are they getting behind the
pop? Well, according to polls, everybody wants them to stand down. But according to public turnout and how much of a stink they're actually kicking up about it, doesn't appear that they really want to actually do it justice kind of thing. You know how people just sometimes lose their motivation, they go, well.
Well, that's right. You can actually, I've been to meetings where you have a meeting about changing something and there's 50 people in the room and they all put their hands up and they all say, we ought to do something about it, and then... They all vote for somebody to go and be the spokesperson, and when that person turns around, there's not a single person behind them. And that's the nature of people. If you want to start a revolution, you've got to make sure that you've got the crowd behind you. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself at the front of nothing.
So that's part of the reason why I think democracy doesn't work very well. I mean, in Latin, it means mob rule, and as far as I know, that hasn't worked out too well at many protests.
No, it's you've got to push people pretty hard before they actually start getting up and protesting. But it's almost it doesn't really happen in New Zealand anymore. You'll get a handful of people, but I think the days of the protesting, the apartheid and South African tour and the nuclear bombs in Mururoa and all that, I think those days of real protesting have gone. Because there isn't the backing through the media. We were all too controlled through the media. And the media think that Len Brown's okay, so that means everybody thinks that the media's okay, so then Len Brown must be okay, so they just back off.
They just go, okay.
Yeah, that's right.
That's freaking ridiculous.
You need some people in the community to actually start telling the truth and talking, but unfortunately, they've all gone to Australia. And... of course, they're all being replaced by these slaves from overseas.
Yeah, I prefer the slaves that were born right here, you know.
Well, you know, in the old days, if you were born in a land or a patch of dirt, that was your home, and you fought for it. This is why when you get countries like America and England and France and Germany and Italy, when they invade somebody else's country, they can never really understand why these people fight so well. And that's because these people have got nowhere else to go. They're fighting for their land. So they will fight to the death because they simply have got nowhere else to go. But if you're asking the English soldier or the American soldier, you know, are you prepared to die in these countries? And they'll say, well, I don't know. Why are we fighting? It's a very different ball game when you're out in a battle and fighting. If you're an American soldier fighting in France and Germany in the Second World War, then you have a reason to fight. You're fighting for democracy, you're fighting to free countries that have been overrun by Nazism and Hitler and all the rest of it. But if you invade Iraq and Afghanistan and all your mates have been shot all around you and you're asked, you know, why are you fighting? A lot of these Americans will just simply say, we don't know. We're just here because we're slaves to the system. But the Afghanis and the Iraqis, they know exactly why they're fighting, and that's why, after 10, 12 years, they're still fighting, because they've got nowhere else to go, and they will continue fighting until the Americans are gone. That's how it works.
How many people have tried to conquer Afghanistan?
Yeah, I know. It's a bit like Napoleon trying to go and cross, you know, and knock over Russia. It's there are some things that are just not going to happen.
Yeah, it's like, I know it's impossible, I know it's insane, but I'm going to throw somebody else's kids at it anyway.
That's right. And as I say, you know, the Afghanis, they know their land and they know their people and they know how to fight. And even though they're fighting a war machine like America and England and they're with all their technology, it is still a fight that the Americans and the British are not winning. Their soldiers are still dying over there and they're not conquering any land. They're not getting anything out of it, of course, except the opium and the oil and the gas. And
well, but I suppose that's enough.
That's enough, yes, that's enough. It's money. It's all you need. There's plenty of money. And that's where... And it doesn't matter if you knock over 100,000 people wearing headbands and cotton clothes and killing these people with F-16 bombers and laser-guided bombs is really easy, especially when you can do it from sitting in your home in California. And that's what it's all about. So it becomes very easy, and you can just knock over these people in their tens of thousands. And who cares? You know, the Western world doesn't really care, because they get their oil, and they get their gas, and they get their lights, and they get their television, and they get their newspaper. But there's an awful lot of people who are dying all over the world to provide it.
It reminds me of the scene in Braveheart when he goes, would you like to use the archers, sire? And he goes, not the archers. Arrows cost money. Use up the Irish. The dead cost nothing.
That's right. That's the attitude. That's how it works. The Romans did that quite well, because whenever they went into a new country, they never put their own soldiers into it. Once they'd knocked over the resistance, as it were, they put in soldiers from all over the empire, and it destabilized the army where. They couldn't get together and say, well, look, I want to go home. You know, they just stayed where they were put. So it was quite amazing. If you go to England and go up to Hadrian's Wall, you find Roman soldiers there from all over the empire. They weren't Romans. They were people from all over the empire. Yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason why the Roman Empire was so successful, is because it's a hell of a lot easier to oppress people if they're not your people.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, they don't care who they're killing or who they're oppressing. But but the Roman Empire was successful because they were a very disciplined group. But in the end, corruption got the better of it. The Romans didn't lose any battles. You know, they didn't collapse because they were up against an enemy that destroyed them. They were up against their own corruption at home in Rome. Rome collapsed, and then the whole of the Roman Empire collapsed. And that's the way the British Empire has gone, and that's the way the American Empire will go and is going. It's just collapsing because of the total corruption at the top.
It's just what happens to empires, all right? Empires get built by a whole bunch of scumbags fiefing off with other people's stuff. Empires fall because they run out of stuff to steal. You know, it's kind of like, there's a famous quote, the trouble with socialism is that eventually you run out of everybody else's money.
That's right. That's exactly it. And the Romans, as you quite rightly pointed out, I mean, the Romans actually conquered the known world. So once they had conquered the known world, there was no other country to rape and pillage. So there was, after that happened, there was a limited amount of money within the system. So all the money started to gravitate towards one area, and of course that became the center of the money, and so the rest of the empire just collapsed because the money was going to one point. If you keep on conquering countries, you can keep on redistributing the wealth, and even the soldiers get a good hand of it. You know, they get their bonus. But if you stop conquering countries because there's nothing left to conquer, then there's no money, so everything falls apart because all of it ends up back in Rome. And this was the way the British Empire went. Once they started losing all their colonies, the money dried up. And America is exactly the same thing that's happened in America. They're being squeezed out from all of the world all over the place because countries are absolutely sick of what the Americans have done. And so they're squeezing them out in a big way. And America will implode. It's only a question of time now before America completely implodes.
Everybody's been talking about the upcoming American implosion, and they've been talking about it for so long. It's almost like they're trying to wear you down and get you to accept the American collapse. But I don't know. But I think there's still a lot of creativity and a lot of... strength left in the American people, well, some of them anyway.
Oh, yeah, don't get me wrong there, but there is a huge difference between Washington and the American people. The American people have got fantastic resilience, and they're hugely creative people and very industrious. I mean, you ask the Americans to do something and they'll get on and do it. Whereas when you go to places like Italy, you've got to have a debate. But it's the economy, it's the American way, it's the American sense of freedom. There's an awful lot of states in America, we found when we were over there, who are actually talking about seceding from the Union. And they've had enough of Washington, and they want to pull out. And we were speaking to a girl in a cafe bar in Montana, I think it was, just before we hopped over the border into Canada, and she recognised our accents, and she said, "Oh, where are you from?" So we said, "New Zealand." And she said, "Oh, usual thing, you know." She said, "I've always wanted to go there." So my wife said, "Why?" And she immediately said, "Oh, well, you know, it's such a beautiful country." She said she'd been to Australia, but she didn't have time to go to New Zealand and all that. And then her next question was, "What do you think of America?" So my wife, after 8 weeks of traveling through America, she said, "Your country's screwed." And the girl actually looked quite shocked. But then, amazingly, she bent over double, she slapped her thigh, she burst out laughing, and she said, "You're absolutely right." And then she started telling us how she thought America was in the education system. And she said to me, "What do you think we should do about it?" And on the spur of the moment, I hadn't thought about it at all, but on the spur of the moment, I said, "You need to break away. The various states need to break away from Washington and start recreating your own identity and start looking after your own money." And she, again, she looked quite shocked, and she looked around the room to see who was listening, and there was nobody else in place. But she was worried, you see. She had to look around to see who was listening. And then she said, "You know, there are a number of people who are talking that way now." And that was quite amazing because, I mean, as I say, I just thought of it on the spur of the moment, but it was quite clear that there are a lot of people in America who are thinking that their states could do very well, thank you, without the backing of Washington and hang on to their money and their identity. So it's an interesting, America's going to be going through some interesting times, but certainly the America of 1945 has completely disappeared. And the America of 1969 that put a man on the moon, that has also disappeared. So what we have left now is just a monster that's just going around with drones all over the world, just creating wars and unrest, and thriving on it and making money out of it. But it's up to the world to turn around and say, to stop them. And I think they have, because they did in Syria. Good old John Kerry and Barack Obama were absolutely determined they were going to go into Syria and just bomb everybody, just like they did in Libya.
Those guys are just frickin' vermin.
Yeah. Who? What, in Syria?
No. John Kerry.
Yeah, I know.
Pacho Barry.
Well, you see, they were determined. I mean, they were telling me, it was all over the news, every channel was saying it, John Kerry was saying it, you know, we're going to go in there, we're going to sort it out, we've got all our fleets and aircraft carriers and cruise missiles and all the rest of it. And they didn't. And I think the world hasn't woken up to it yet, but history was made a few months ago, because there were some countries in this planet of ours who actually stood up to America and said, "No, you're not going to do it. You're going to leave Syria alone." And the only concession they got out of it was the assumed chemical weapons that were there that had to be deactivated and sent offshore. And that, and after that, who gives a shit about Syria anymore? You know, nobody really talks about Syria. You know, so one minute we're hearing all over the news about the desperate situation in Syria and the millions dying and the disease and all the rest of it, and then all of a sudden nobody gives a shit about Syria anymore, and we're all focusing on the Ukraine. So, you know, you have to wonder where
which is incidentally another proxy war that the United States is trying to start.
That's exactly right. They'll just keep on going around the planet just to stir things up all over.
When the hell was there actually... Like, seriously, I've had a look at, like, the financing of who financed Hitler in World War II and all of this other kind of stuff, right? And it turns out that the Americans and whoever else is fighting are never the ones financing themselves. They're always borrowing off the same big group of frickin' banks to scum anyway. So it doesn't matter why the war is fought. The point is that everybody gets in debt as a result of it. I mean, like, how much money would you borrow if the alternative to borrowing more than the other guy was for him to defeat you and kill you and enslave your people? You borrow as much as you wanted, right? As much as you could, so that you could kill and enslave the other guy's people before he does the same thing to you. The irony is, if even if you win your war against the bad guy who's screwing you over and destroying your country, you still get enslaved by the bankers.
That's right. That's right. Nobody wins at the end of the day. It's just the banks and the people at the top that control it all.
What was that old saying? A war doesn't determine who wins or loses. It only determines who is left.
Yes, and who's controlling. Who's in control at the end of the day? I wrote another book just recently on the politics of 9/11 in America and all the rest of it. And in it, I've got a chapter there that talks about the American Civil War. And one of the things that, if you ever study the American Civil War, that one of the things that crops up time and time again is that the American soldiers, North and South, often could not understand why they were fighting. You know, even in the middle of a fight, I think it was at Gettysburg, we went there and visited. It's a very it's an interesting place to go to and visit Gettysburg. There's so much to learn there. But one of the incredible things that we read about was on, I think, the last day of the battle, some Confederate soldiers were trying desperately to take control of a hill. And a Union man shot a Confederate guy. Didn't kill him, but shot him, and then went down the hill to look for him and care for him. And one of the first things he said was, "What the hell are you guys doing here? Why are you fighting?" And this was a question that cropped up time and time again in the American Civil War between the Union soldiers and the Confederate soldiers. They didn't know why they were fighting each other, brother and brother and father against son. And it was just a corporate war. It was the beginning of American corporate war. The North wanted power and control and money, and they had Washington and the federal government. The South actually just wanted their identity and their market, which was the Southern market was actually expanding at a phenomenal rate, and that was severely worrying the North. And this is what I wrote in the book, in that it's all about who's going to dominate at the end, who's going to be the power broker, and who controls the money, the purse strings. Well, at the end of the war, there was no question that the South was physically and financially ruined. And this is supposed to be the Union, you know, the America, the land of the free. Well, it wasn't. It was the North versus the South, and the North wanted the money and the clout and the power, and they got it. They won the battle.
It was the land of the free. Now it's the home of the slaves.
That's right. The whole idea of having a president and Congress and freedom and all the rest of it is an absolute eyewash, because at the end of the day, they might as well call their president Your Majesty, because they've ended up with exactly the same system. You know, they went over there and they had their states and they had their fields, and they took it all off the local Indians, of course. But once they had established themselves over there, they fought for them, for their independence from England. And that was fair enough. England was taxing them and wanted more money out of them, and they turned around and said, "No, you can't do this, we won't have it." And they fought the English to have independence, and that was okay, that worked well. But then it all fell to pieces, because then they joined up all the states in this confederacy. And as soon as they did that, of course, you have to have a boss. You have to have a president. You have to have a king. You have to have a leader. And once you've got that, you've got a god. And once you've got a god, they want everything. So the whole thing fell down. In a matter of just a few generations, what all these people that left Europe for this freedom of individuals, of freedom of rights, freedom of expression, it was all taken away from them as soon as they created the United States. Because it just meant that there was a boss. You had a king. Before that, they were all free. Each state was independent. Every man was independent. Every man was free. And then they all joined together and called themselves a union. It's a bit like having a coalition, isn't it?
Coalition of the Willing or Coalition of the Killing or...
It was the slang word for the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, the Bush administration was always saying, oh, look, our allies, our coalition partners, you know, it made it sound very...
We need a coalition for peace, like a coalition of the chilling.
A coalition of the what?
Of the chilling, you know? Just like send them into countries and just like I don't know, just go chill out, bro. You know, stop trying to kill each other out.
Well, that's the difference between having a court of justice and a court of law. you have a court of justice when you want truth, and you have a court of law when you want to bust everything.
Yeah. Well, I said for a long time that the legal system's supposed to do what's lawful, but the only thing they're capable of doing is what's awful.
Yeah, it's but you're following a. It's following a doctrine. It's like having all these drink drivers. They have a drink driver and they let him off. And then they catch this drink driver again and they let him off. Then they catch him again and they let him off. The law is an ass. But then what you've got is these other lawyers that come around and say, oh, well, if you take away this guy's license, he can't work. So, you know, you can't drive anywhere, so he can't work. So you have a dispensation on the law. So you have a law, but it doesn't actually exist. It doesn't work in practice. And then all of a sudden you'll get things on Campbell Live where they say, oh, well, this guy's got 10 crimes where, you know, where he's been caught driving, loaded up with alcohol, and they still give him back his license. And then people turn around and say, well, how can you have it 10 times or 100 times? You know, how do these people rack up $500,000 worth of parking fines and unpaid fines? Well, you know, you've basically got a system that is just simply not working. Because if you're going to have a fine, then make it work. And if you're going to have to make it criminal to drink and drive, then take away the license, take away the car, and put the person in jail. Now, of course, if these people have a severe medical problem or a psychiatric problem or an emotional problem, well, then you deal with it, but you deal with it in a different way. But the system of law in this country is that you just keep on giving the people back their license, you keep on giving them back the hammer they used to kill their children with, and I can't believe this country and the number of children that get killed here. It's just.
Oh, especially the amount that get die in stake here.
Yeah, it defies belief. When I came to New Zealand, I couldn't believe the apathy that people have towards a child being murdered. I can't comprehend it. I just cannot comprehend it. But it's been like that for the 30 years I've been in this country. If a child dies, it's business as usual the next day. Who cares? There's no protests in the streets. There's no nothing. The politicians have been jumping up for 30 years, and we are still no nearer getting a resolution to the problem or dealing with the problem whatsoever. And there'll be another child killed in the next few weeks. It'll go on and on and on. But, you know, when you live in a system that simply doesn't care, then you can't deal with it.
They simply don't care because I think it's what we were talking about earlier, is that they've lost their humanity. And I don't, it just seems like predatory, more or less. I think that's really the only word I can use to describe this this culture, is just it's ruled by predators. I mean, it's no different to how a man... let's say, make a whole bunch of cows, live in a paddock for a while, take care of them before killing them and eating them.
Yeah.
It's no different. We're being farmed.
We are being farmed, I think. Everything about us, telecom, Vodafone, Genesis Energy, Contact Energy, Fonterra, forestry, gold, oil, everything. There isn't an aspect of our life today that isn't a profit-making agenda, following the profit-making agenda. And humanity is part of it. We are being bred, or people are being bred, to be dehumanized. You only have to watch the television programs, the computer games that children are playing. It is actually quite astonishing to talk to some people and talk to them about young people and talk to them about life and death. And they look bemused. There is a look of complete bewilderment in their eyes to try and understand the difference between life and death. And you often see it in the media. When the Christchurch earthquake happened and they began to realise that people had died down there, you had idiot reporters going down and sticking microphones in people's faces who are obviously distressed and saying to them, well, how do you feel about this? You know, if somebody ever did that to me, I would just simply plant them there and then. You know, it's such a stupid question. There is no...
Hello, you think, scumbag!
There's no...
Crack him in the face, and then grab the microphone off him. Now, how do you feel? Hey! Hey!
I would ram it up their backsides and ask them, how do you feel about it? And then
is
when
this
they
an audible proctology exam?
Then, and of course, what they do in this country, and this is what the Law Society does, is that the first thing they do is put fear into you by threatening you with taking you to court and suing you and taking away your house, your car, your family and everything else. This is the standard normal practice for lawyers to protect themselves, is that they will threaten you with court action. Now, of course, if you, like I did, and this is an interesting thing, when I started to really dive into this case that I was mentioning earlier, I actually spoke to one solicitor in New Plymouth. And, of course, the word was starting to bounce around the corridors of power that Ian Paquin was making waves. And so this solicitor, after dealing with some issues with the case, then turned to me and he said, oh, you know, Ian, you've got to be really careful, you know, about saying bad things about solicitors, or one solicitor in particular. And I said, oh, why is that? And he said, well, you know, she can sue you for defamation of character and blah, blah, blah. And I just looked at him and I said, yep. And I said, and then what? And do you know, this guy just looked at me and looked at me and looked at me, and 20 seconds went past. And he said, oh, is that what you're doing? And what I was basically, what I had in my mind was the fact that, yes, you can threaten me with suing me. The trouble is, the truth is on my side. And if this solicitor wanted to sue me, all well and good, because I'll meet her in court, and then I will say what I have to say. And the last thing that they want to do is to have all of their shit dragged through a public court. So there is not the slightest chance in the world that they'll ever sue you. As long as you are right and you've got the facts on your side, and there's no way that these people will ever see you. And this is what happened when I wrote this book. I named all these solicitors and lawyers who have been involved in this case. I named them in the book, there on the front page. And I haven't had a single phone call from any of them. And then I wrote another book, which I printed out last year, and I named them all again. And I still haven't had any phone calls.
I always wondered why solicitors never got booked for solicitation.
That's a good point.
I mean, ain't that illegal?
I actually asked this solicitor, I said, what's the difference between a solicitor and a lawyer? And you know, he couldn't answer. I was absolutely gobsmacked. I thought, I'm asking a legitimate question here, because this was back in the days when I had nothing to do with the law. You know, the law was there in the background. You know, if you go through a red light, you get stopped, you get taken to court, you find... $100, and that to me was the law. That's all the interest in the law I had. But when I got involved with this case, it really opened my eyes, and I started reading books and learning all about these people. And one of the things I couldn't find in the books was what the difference was between a solicitor and a lawyer. So I asked this solicitor, and he couldn't answer. And I thought, well, no, that's absolutely typical. That's why these people, you cannot communicate with these people, because they're actually as thick as shit. They are really some of the most ignorant people you'll ever meet in your life. I can say that straight from the heart. I mean, I'm 58 years old. I've traveled around the world. I've been a marine engineer and done a lot of things in my life. And I have never, ever in my life met anybody like these people. They're stupid beyond belief. You cannot communicate with these people in any shape or form. So the only way I could... This is why I wrote the book. Because if you can't talk to them, you can't solve any problems, you can't deal with the issues. And even though they've set up systems and they had a complaints authority to complain to, I mean, that was a waste of time as well. And then when that fails in those days, you could go to the... there was a word for them, I can't remember what it was. No, it wasn't the Ombudsman, it was...
The Solicitor General?
No. The government had produced four people that were designated areas throughout New Zealand, and they were given, if you weren't satisfied with the Law Society's dealings with the complaint, you could go to these people, and they were like an ombudsman, but they were an officially designated one by the government. But they had no powers whatsoever. The whole thing was a scam, a complete game. But anyway, I wrote to this person and got absolutely nothing back, and that was a waste of time. So I wrote to the Justice Minister, and that was a waste of time. So I wrote to the Prime Minister, and that was a waste of time. Then the Solicitor General and the Governor General. So there was nobody left in New Zealand for me to write to. And at that point, then I realised, well, if you can't talk to these people and they're not going to talk to you, the only thing left for me to do was to write a book. So I wrote this book, and I told them all I was going to do it. It wasn't as though it was a shock to them. I think they were just surprised that I actually went ahead and did it. They all thought that there's just no way that I could write anything that could disturb them, you know, because they are lawyers. They control the system. So anyway, I wrote this book and printed out 700 copies and sent them all around the country. And the silence was shattering, absolutely shattering. But it tells you a lot, you know. It's like looking for a black hole. You can't see a black hole. So what you do is you look for everything around it that's just disappearing. And it's the same with lawyers. The fact that you can write a book and name all these people and call them all sorts of things than I did and get no response whatsoever tells you more truth than if you went there and actually spoke to them. But you see, it's a no-win situation.
Well, of course, you wouldn't get any truth if you went there and spoke to them yourself anyway.
No, well, this is right. And this is what happened, you see. This is why I wrote the book, because you physically cannot communicate with these people. They don't.
I was saying for a while now, Ian, that New Zealand is so corrupt that the people who are in charge of exposing corruption don't report any of it because they're too corrupt.
That's right. They're all in on it. This is what I proved. See, I followed the... back in 2006, 2007, I was still a naive guy that actually thought that there were organisations and tribunals and committees that dealt with these problems, and there isn't. This is what I found, that I had to prove it to myself first before I could do anything. So, you know, I confronted the solicitor at the time and got nowhere. So then I confronted the senior partner of the firm and got absolutely nowhere. And so then I went to the Taranaki District Law Society and got nowhere. So then I went to the New Zealand Law Society. Yes, I went to them, and they admitted that they had absolutely no responsibility. It was incredible. The individual, the local law district law societies, they had total authority over any complaints. The New Zealand Law Society had no authority to do anything about it. So then, of course, I thought, well, you know, the New Zealand Law Society only exists because of the government grant. So I went to the Justice Minister, and he wrote a letter to me and told me he wasn't responsible for anything. So then I thought, well, I'll write to the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister sent me a letter saying thank you for your letter. And then I wrote to the Governor General and the Solicitor General and got two more letters saying thank you for your letter. So then I wrote another letter to the... that body to do with corporate fraud and all this.
The Prime Minister's office?
Yeah, well, that was the way.
Oh, I don't know. That was the one that that perpetrates the corporate fraud. Oh, yeah. Well, they incidentally are involved in a lot of the world.
Yeah.
The country's serious frauds at the moment.
So I just kept on getting letters saying, with various letterheads, all politely saying, thank you very much for your letter, blah, 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 and absolutely nothing happened. So, what I did was I actually proved that from the solicitor all the way up to the very top of the mountain, the midden, there was no responsibility. Nobody gave a shit. So I thought, when I got to that point, I knew then that I can write a book, because if nobody's going to listen to you, then you're entitled to write a book and say all these things. So that's exactly what I did. And it upset them. It upset them quite a lot. But they won't talk to me.
Do you like the whole them being upset thing, or are you kind of like, you know, one day they're going to pull a Winston Peters on me from all his enemies from the old wine box inquiry? And
No, I've got no concerns over that whatsoever. And I mean, it was satisfying in the fact that I wrote a book and I could just take away their manner. They don't have a lot of prestige these days, especially in Taranaki. They're idiots to the nth degree. But that was a one-off. I mean, I did that. I mean, I could follow it up with another book or two to do with the entire process. It's not difficult when you're dealing with such supreme idiots. It's not difficult.
Oh, they're like a gold mine. You know, they're like the Three Stooges or something like that. It doesn't matter what the hell they're doing. It's freaking hilarious.
Yeah, yeah, it is hilarious. You've only got to look at some of the things that go on television, you know, when you get all these lawyers and stuff. Look at that, what was her name? Davina Murray, who gave an iPhone to that criminal in jail. I mean, she broke and busted and bent every rule in the book. There were no ethics to be had there at all, and yet she felt free and easy and completely unfazed by doing what she was doing. And Eventually, the Law Society decided they might do something about it. But this is the attitude that they have. The attitude has completely changed from 100 years ago. You know, people had ethics, they had morals. They had a sense of what was right and wrong within the individual. But now you have 11,000 lawyers, solicitors and barristers in this country whose sole purpose it is to find ways of destroying the law so then they can make money. That is how they are morally and ethically guided these days. And the government condones it. You know, the government absolutely encourages it. They
well,
can't.
That's true. I think, was it earlier this year or maybe last year, a couple of years, but I forget when, but the national government's in power and they were approached to look into judicial corruption in this country, considering most of the judges are related by, like, first cousin or something like that.
Oh, that's absolutely right.
Yeah. And the government says, well, if there is corruption, we don't want to be seen to be doing anything about it because that might be bad for our public profile.
Yeah, they can play games with it as much as they want, because one of the major, major arguments that the Law Society has for having being a separate entity from government is that if they are being controlled by government, then of course the idea then is that government will interfere with judicial proceedings. So the argument, of course, and it's a logical and legitimate argument, that that's how it should be, because otherwise you have to have an independent authority with the law to uphold the law. Now, the government is still the ultimate maker of laws. Theoretically, the politicians are supposed to get down in government there, in parliament, and talk about it and thrash out a new law, you know, about ownership of land or flying planes or drugs or whatever. And then after that, the courts uphold the law. And the government no longer then interferes with any of the judicial systems. But the reality is that, of course, that the politicians and the lawyers and the judges are all hobnobbing together, and they're all discussing the cases, and they all know what's going on. And but there's enormous profits to be made, absolutely billions of dollars. So obviously, some of these cases that you hear, these murder cases, and what, they get dragged out for donkey's years because it makes money. It keeps the system affluent and effluent. It's what makes it's the oil in the cogs of the system.
I thought effluent was poo.
It is. That's what they are.
I'm effluent in three languages.
We live in an effluent society.
And especially in the Waikato.
Oh, I don't know much about the Waikato. I've never lived there. I've driven through it many times.
It's cow country. They named their rugby team after the Mulu men, as in the cow men. So it must be full of cow crap.
It must be. There's a lot of cow crap there. But even worse
than cow crapper crapper.
Yeah, I used to struggle over these New Zealand names. Used to call Wonga Momona Wonga Momona.
Wonga Momona.
Well.
It sounds like a cocktail, you know.
I know.
Like a mimosa.
And Pio Pio, you know, when somebody said it's not Pio Pio, it's Pew Pew. And I thought, well, how do you get Pew Pew out of P-I-O P-I-O? You know, you just have to learn how to say these things when you come over to New Zealand. But I've got it pretty good sorted out. I mean, I can say Pohutukawa now. I struggled over Pohutukawa for quite a long time.
Yeah.
But we have a town around the coast here called Ōkura. It's Ōkura.
Ōkura,
There are five different ways of saying it. It's Ōkura, Ōkura, Ōkura. Ōkura, yeah. Nobody actually knows how to say it.
Or eventually you give up and just go, oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah. All the locals know what you're talking about because they all know that nobody knows. So they know what
they all know that nobody knows. Yeah. The only thing that everybody knows is that nobody knows.
It's like going up to Otahuhu and Waikanae and all these different places. You get to know it after a while. Tukanis. Yeah.
Well, I think New Zealand culture's got this this really unique twerk and what have you. Did I say twerk?
You did.
I meant quirk. Do you know the difference between twerks and quirks?
You'll have to explain it to me. It sounds like the difference between quarks and atomic theory.
No, but all they do, drink Ferengi bone beer. But the other element is twerking and what was the other thing that I said before? Twerking and something, I forget. Anyway, twerking is when a chick puts her bum in the air and kind of like shakes it around and what have you. It's big in the rap videos.
Oh, that's a new one on me. I've never heard of that.
Yeah. Well, you don't sound like the kind of man who watches too many hip-hop videos.
No, I don't. I'm a great lover of music and the arts, but there are one or two of the modern
ones. But hip-hop and rap are not one of them.
Oh, God, rap, I think, is... it's probably best if I don't give my opinion on rap in this program.
I've done a John Key rap.
Did you?
Yeah.
How did it go?
Incidentally, I have the thing here. We've got the GCSB and the TICS. His name's John Key. For a liar, he's the best. Crack it open at nice national parks for mining. Corporate cronies and his mates seem to take a shining. He's got shares in uranium and Jackson Mining. It's amazing how TV news can be so blinding. Want to restrict our snapper but not commercial operation. That's privatising the oceans, if I understand the equation. You got fracking consents to pollute the water table. Hydraulic chemicals and pressure make the land unstable. Deep sea oil bids going cheap for oil barons. Gulf of Mexico, BP, now the land is barren. And the Exxon Valdez got John Key, please. Wipe that bankster smile off your face before it's too late. His name's John Key, the prime sinister. Doesn't even measure up to be a minister with the lies and deception. In your own words, you lose the election when the people get heard.
That was quite good.
Yeah. It goes on, but... Yeah.
Who wrote that?
That's me.
Oh, that was good. I'm impressed.
Yeah. I mean, I just hate John Key so much... that I just can't get it out of the... Like, I do pictures, I do songs, I just rant about him on radio. Nothing seems to get the rage out of my blood vessels. It just doesn't work.
Hasn't he got a lovely smile, though?
I don't know. I don't know.
Don't you feel that when he's smiling, he's just looking down his nose at you and he says, well, I know what I'm doing and I know that you're getting screwed.
I don't know. It just feels like some kind of a movie where a demon suddenly possesses one of your loved ones, and that demon then smiles at you through your loved one's eyes, and it really, really freaks you out because you see that the thing that you love isn't there anymore, and and there's nothing but darkness and sadness and sorrowful woe.
Yep,
you know, that's right.
That's what my wife has said. She said, you know. He smiles, but the smile never reaches his eyes.
Yeah. I said that, actually. I was outdoors. It doesn't happen often, but it does. And what happened was we went out to go and ambush John Key when he was giving a speech at a school, but we thought maybe not at the school, maybe after when he comes out the gates or something like that. But the intel wasn't good, so there was no Prime Minister to be seen. It was unfortunate, but we just had to deal with it, as you do.
Mm.
And so I started just megaphoning in the general street area. And within 9 minutes, the police showed up. Pretty quick, especially for somebody who's not committing a crime. Although one could argue that free speech is a crime, but especially with the GCSB.
Yeah.
And... what was interesting is that we had a conversation with a cop, and the cop's conversation with us actually lasted longer than the protest did and scored more hits for the protest video.
That's good.
And he said to me, you know, well, do you think that Friday afternoon is the, you know, Pommy Cop, you know, we get a lot of imports over here, just almost as many as Japanese cars. And he says, this is 5 o'clock in the morning, in the afternoon, sorry, in Pukekohe, the appropriate place for this? And I go, yeah. And he goes, why is that? And he says, because we're already here. You know, why wouldn't you protest? And well, I think it's just, I don't expect anything to happen to come out of it, except to have fun on the day that I know that I actually did something and had some fun exposing some scumbaggery.
Yeah, yeah. No, I can appreciate that. When I published my book on the corruption of the New Zealand legal system, I was giving it away all free to everybody. And one of the things I did was I had about 200 of these things all in cardboard boxes, and I went and sat outside the New Plymouth Public Library all Saturday. And it was a beautiful, hot, sunny day. And I thought, you know, I'm bound to catch people who read books who go in and out of the library, and it seems to be a logical place to give them away. So I sat there on my own for the whole day from about 8:30, 9 o'clock through to 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I was pretty sunburned at the end of it. But I gave away 74 copies, I think. And all day I was thinking that there's bound to be a solicitor, there's bound to be somebody that comes up and talks to me about this. And I had a whacking great big sign next to me saying Law Society, Corruption, Stupidity and Incompetence. And I found that you still had to talk to people. People didn't necessarily come over and talk to you even when they read the sign. So I was just saying good morning and good afternoon to everybody, and eventually, you know, you pull them over and they say, you know, what's this? I tell them, and I said, you know, it's a free copy. And but the police never arrived, and I did have two solicitors turn up. One turned up, and she looked at the sign, and she looked at me, and she said, oh, what's this? And I told her, and she read the cover, and she started going through it, and she said, how much are these? And I said, oh, it's free. Do you know that was the biggest shock to her? She could actually understand that somebody could write a book about the corruption of the legal system, but she couldn't understand that I was giving it away free. And really, that's a good indicator of how a lawyer's mind works. So anyway, I said, take one. And it was very awkward for her, you know, not to have to pay for it. But she eventually took one. And then another solicitor came up, and she was asking me about it, and she was very furtive. She was sort of looking over her shoulder quite a lot. And she finally admitted that she was a solicitor. So I said, well, I'll take a copy. And she ran away. It was quite incredible. And after she ran away, I thought, oh, she's running off to tell somebody, and then the police will come round and somebody. But nobody ever did. And I gave away a lot of copies that day. So there's quite a few hundred circulating around New Plymouth. But it does show up. But it was quite good. I was interested to talk to people. And again, once it was incredible. The number of people, once they realised what I was actually doing there and why I was giving away these books, the stories that started to pour out of these people's mouths about how they've been ripped off by lawyers and solicitors, how they lost hundreds of thousands of dollars, it was just mind-blowing. And some of them actually tried to do something about it, but unfortunately, you know, the system being what it is, they got nowhere. It was actually just costing them more to fight the system. So they just give up. And that's the way the system's being carefully manipulated and carefully controlled. And people do, they just give up. And, you know, they accept the loss of $50,000, $100,000, $200,000. They give up. And the apathy and the destruction of people's personalities and characters and their will to live is quite incredible. And that's the way the system works. That's what it does. It's designed that way. But you see, and this is why when I wrote the book, it was a complete shock to them, because... you see, when you think about it, I wrote one book. All I had to do was sit at the laptop and write one book. But computers are wonderful things, and printers are even better, because you can go to the little box and it says, how many copies would you like? And I just printed 700, and it just spews out books. So it's quite good. But I only wrote it once. And then you send it all around the country, and then if you send off 700 copies, 700 people are going to read it. And then 700 more people are going to read it, because they'll be passed on to somebody else. So, you know, I wrote one copy, but thousands and thousands and thousands of people have had to read it. And they have wasted thousands and thousands and thousands of hours doing it, just as they forced me to waste time writing it. By writing a book, you force them to waste time reading the damn thing. And so the spin-offs to writing a book is fantastic. This is why books are, the government and the World Organization are trying to shut down books, because books are very powerful things. And this is why publishing houses... breaking up. You know, all the small publishing houses that we used to have 30, 40, 50 years ago have all gone because they've all been amalgamated. And then the big publishing houses that are left over, they have total control on the publication of books. So the number of good books that you get to read in the bookshop now, if there are any left in the high street, are zero. The only books that you'll get are cookery books and The Flight of the Condor book, or, you know, or How to Maintain Your Harley Motorcycle. But to get decent books describing the system and the world and what's going on, and good fictional books, good drama books and all the rest of it, they're all being shut down because the publishing houses and the politics have total control of books now. This is why books like 50 Shades of Grey can sell millions of copies, and yet it's a pretty nothing book.
And yet Obama, the postmodern coup.
Yeah.
What's that?
But we live in a funny world, and that's. But if you write a book, that's one of the beauties of writing a book is you get people to read it, and they can actually hold it in their hands and hold your opinion and your thoughts in their hands and put it down, and the next day they can pick it up and read it again, that sort of thing. You see, we live in a world where if you turn on the television, they flick 10 scenes at you a second, and your eyes are just mesmerized by this flashing light on these scenes. You can't focus on anything. And all of television now is like that. And there's music banging away in the background all the time to obliterate your brain. And that's television. It's total brainwashing of the people. If people were to throw away their television, society would change overnight. We'd all be, all people would start thinking again. They'd start talking to each other again. But television, unfortunately, controls their brains. It tells them what to think.
That reminds me of the speech in Network. All you people re-watch television, you eat like the tube, you drink like the tube, you dress your children like the tube.
Yep.
You're even starting to think like the tube.
That's exactly it. This is why, you know, if you turn on the television in New Zealand, if you get Sky Television or Television New Zealand or whatever, all you get are New Zealand trash, absolute trash. You get American trash. And you get a few good old-fashioned 1960s, 70s English comedy programs. You don't get anything from Italy. You don't get anything from France. You don't get anything from Germany, Spain, Sweden, Holland. All of these countries that all have their programs and interesting programs and drama programs and nature programs and science programs and all the rest of it. All of these countries produce them, and we don't get any of it. We are programmed to have New Zealand trash and American trash. And you would think that in a world where we have such great communication facilities, you know, with satellites and Sky Television, where we would actually have a solid gold 24-carat television program every single day, every single night. But we don't. We have 24-hour, 7-day-a-week trash. And it's been designed that way. That's what we do. This is why, you know, just to try and keep people watching television, they put old English drama programs and comedy programs on, just to give some people some relief somewhere in the day from the 24 hours of shit that they have to watch.
But tell us what you really think, Ian.
Well, if you, what else do you want to know? What else do you want to know about writing or the Law Society or people?
Well, I was wondering, where did you get the moral backbone to stand up against the scumbaggery filth?
It's just a sense of the difference between right and wrong in me. It's actually quite powerful. And it's taken me a great deal of my life to actually learn it and appreciate who I am in that area. Because I am, by and large, 99% pure pacifist. I will run away from a fight given half an opportunity. But what I found in my life is that sometimes the fight will come to you regardless. And then you use all sorts of other tactics and strategies to avoid that fight, and that's what I used to do. But again, the fight is often determined to come to you. So in the end, you get pushed to the edge of the cliff, and you have a choice. You either jump and you die, or else you turn around and you start fighting. And I learned in my life that my instinct is to turn around and I start fighting. And the interesting thing is that what I learned was that while in 1 second I was a pure pacifist and I wouldn't lift a fist to anybody, and you push me to the edge of the cliff and I turn around, I'll turn around and I'll use whatever means possible to destroy that entity. experts trying to kill me. And the first time I did it, I was a surprise to myself about what I did. But it was an even greater surprise to myself that I succeeded comprehensively in what I was doing. And you learn a lot from that experience, and then it happened to me several times more. And when it came to fighting the Law Society here in Taranaki, I was actually quite experienced at understanding the psychology of bullies. And that's what it is. It's just ignorant bullies. And that's what the New Zealand Law Society is, and that's what the Taranaki District Law Society is. It's just a bunch of ignorant bullies. So it was quite easy once I learnt how to deal with these people. And once I'd established all the facts, you cannot talk to these people. They're too stupid. So then I wrote a book. And the conviction to write the book is simply the fact that what they're doing is wrong. And I simply will not stand by and watch other people being destroyed, have their lives, their families, their communities being destroyed by these pieces of shit, because they are just inhuman vacuums.
Freaking garbage, you know?
They are. They're total garbage. There are one or two good ones in there.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like, I don't know, 99% of police officers make the other 1% look bad, you know? That kind of...
Well, in actual fact, Vinny, one of the things that's quite curious with this country is that the police force in this country take an enormous amount of stick from the public, certain aspects, certain areas of the public, and the media when they decide to do something. But my experience of the New Zealand police is that New Zealand is blessed with, I believe, one of the best police forces on the planet.
Yeah, they're really, really hard to bribe. I've tried.
They are good people. There are the ones...
Well, some of them are, some of them aren't. It's kind of like 50-50, I'd say. Like about half my interactions with police have been really, really good, and about half of them have been outright scumbags who just try to basically start a fight with you for no reason, like even when you're asking them for help or something.
Yeah, you're an Aucklander, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's different up in Auckland. No, by and large, I have found, I mean, I come from a background which is French and English and Scottish and Welsh, and I've travelled around the world and risked life and limb sometimes in some of the countries I've been ashore in when I've got off ships, you know, in South America and Panama and some of these places. You really have to be careful what you do. But no, I can honestly say that New Zealand has one of the best police forces on the planet. They are dedicated people. They deal with an enormous amount of crap. If there are any mountain rescue, air search, sea rescues and all that, you'll find the police there. They're incredibly skilled men. Many of them are, you know, they have enormous talents and great skills. And they understand the country that they live in. There are scumbags. I mean, I've met one or two. But they are, you'll get that in any society, in any walk of life, in any business. There's always one or two that are just pieces of crap. And they get tolerated. But by and large, the New Zealand police force is one of the best, I think, in the planet. Unfortunately, they have to deal with a law society that is one of the worst on the planet. And, I mean, there are some bad ones around the world. I mean, third world countries are notorious for having legal systems that are just pure corruption. But New Zealand has an awful one, with awful, awful people in it. As I say, there are one or two.
Well, you've heard of fractal universe theory, right?
No, I haven't.
It's kind of like, you know how a hologram works? You look into one part of the hologram and what you see is the whole image of the whole hologram repeating itself, and then you look in further and it keeps repeating itself over and over?
Yep.
Right. That's kind of like how the fractal universe theory is, you know, like you go from a cell to a human body to a planet to a galaxy to a red dwarf star cluster, so on and so forth, and it looks like the same repeating pattern. And so what I've discovered is that New Zealand is kind of like an example of fractal scumbaggery. For each instance of scumbaggery you look into, you start to see that all new whole entire universes of scumbaggery start to come to light.
Yeah, and it's something that's been very carefully cultivated over the last 30 years in this country. And the main contenders in this country for it are the political system, our so-called MPs, the legal system, and what's the third one? There was a third one I had in my mind. The corporations. These people totally control this country, which means that politically you can't fight it, legally you can't fight it, and the corporates are making all the money out of it. And this is the way it's been contrived. This is the way New Zealand has been made. And MMP is one of the most subtle pieces of corruption you could imagine. We have a government where half of our MPs shouldn't really be called MPs, because they do not represent any constituents in any constituency in New Zealand. They are elected purely on the basis of the party's vote for them. So you can actually have somebody placed into very high office in government in this country who has never ever been elected or supported or voted for by any New Zealander. And this is the way MMP works. You've also got half the government who are paid to say whatever the party leader wants them to say.
Also, you have the vast amount of our prime ministers over the years all being educated overseas and working overseas, and then just come back here and just take the country over. They don't just sit in New Zealand, watch it get really bad, and then just go, you know what, I need to do something about this. No, they just sit overseas, and they see that New Zealand hasn't gotten quite as messed up as where they're living at the moment, so they come back and you go, you know, I've got to help the country catch up, you know, it's my duty.
No, they were doing, you just got to look at all the prime ministers we've had over the last 30 years. From David Longy was a disastrous little boy. He was a good speaker, and you know, he was quite eloquent. He would make these wonderful speeches, but he was actually a very naive little boy. The Rainbow Warrior thing really took him to task. I had just arrived in New Zealand, and a year later, the Rainbow Warrior was sunk by the French. And David Longy was standing up, and he was saying all the right words. But then the French, to try and get their two saboteurs out of the country, started putting the squeeze on. And poor old David Longy, he just had no idea what he was dealing with. He's just coming out with all this rhetoric about he was going to lock all these Frenchmen away for 20 years, 30 years, and blah, blah, blah. And of course, within a couple of years, they'd been transferred to that island in the Pacific, and then a couple of years later, they're free. And that's the way the system works. He had just no idea what was going on in the world. And then after that, you have the likes of Jim Bolger and Jenny Shipley and Helen Clark, and now we've got John Key. And they're all sitting in American beds. They've all got American friends and American money. I mean, for goodness sake, John Key was playing golf with Barack Obama at Christmas. This is high-pressure dealings of the way New Zealand works, the political system of New Zealand, and we're just a corporation now. We have no say in running of the country whatsoever. And New Zealanders are slaves to the system. And it's just no surprise. You just look at the names. And none of these people actually work for the country. You've only got to mention a referendum in this country. You know, you can have a referendum with 80% of the people saying, you know, we want change, and the government turns around and says, no, we don't have to do it. It's just a waste of time. We do what we're told.
We just don't have any choice in the matter, you know. I mean, they've corrupted everything. They've destroyed everything that used to define the country of itself. And I think basically the country's in this massive identity crisis where they don't even... Kiwis, born Kiwis today, don't know what it's like to be a Kiwi. They got no idea.
They have no idea.
No freaking clue. And I think once you detach a society away from their own sense of identity, then it leaves it open for somebody outside that society to control their destiny.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Once you've destroyed a community, which is what the system does, this is why you have amalgamation. This is why Auckland has amalgamated all the mayors. Because what you do is you take away Auckland's regional identity, and you have one great big cesspool called Auckland. And it soaks up billions of dollars to make roads and casinos and tunnels. It doesn't do a thing for community and society whatsoever, but it is the focal point for making money. And in Taranaki here, they try to make out in the newspapers here that amalgamation of councils was great, and they were talking about doing that in Taranaki, amalgamating the three different councils. And then you've got idiots appearing in the newspapers saying, oh, that... there's a lot of people saying, oh, it's a great thing, you know, you do this, you save a lot of money. Nothing could be further from the truth. If you amalgamate, you get rid of 90% of the people that have got any intelligence, and you place into power a very well-paid CEO and a well-paid mayor, and you completely control and have doctrine over an area of New Zealand. And this is what's been going on in this country. You amalgamate all the... milk manufacturers. You know, all the independent milk producers all get put under Fonterra. Fonterra is multi-billion dollar, and they can do anything they want. And there used to be rules about having monopolies, but the government threw that out the window. And this is what
I call Fonterraism.
Yeah, yeah. Look at Air New Zealand. Air New Zealand decided it was bigger than its own boots and tried to take over Singapore Airlines. And somehow or other, they've never really explained it on television, but Air New Zealand managed to completely bankrupt itself. So New Zealand taxpayer had to buy its own airline to get it back on its feet again. And this is what the government does. I mean, look at the South Canterbury Finance. That goes bust. And the figure was, what was it? $1.6 billion of taxpayers' money goes into bailing out a private investment company. Why? Because there were an awful lot of people who had lost an awful lot of money in there that shouldn't have lost a lot of money, and they shouldn't have put their money in there in the first place. But
actually, you may have got the wrong end of the stick about that. I've interviewed Paul Carruthers, who's kind of like the guy who was standing in and speaking for Alan Hubbard during that whole debacle. What was his name? Who was Simon Power, I think, was the Justice Minister at the time. And you know who Michael Stiassny is?
No.
Quartermentha, they do all the big receiverships. So they did the receivership for the Crayfer Farms, the receivership for basically any big receivership that's in the media gets done by this guy, who's incidentally a personal friend of John Key. And which bank does all the government's banking? The Westpac Bank, isn't it?
Right.
And in order to shut down a company and put it into statutory management, you have to have evidence that it's actually losing money or it's out of control or they actually do something like that, which means there has to be an investigation. Now, how long do you think it would take for a government agency to do an investigation on a multi-billion dollar company like that?
Quite a long time.
How about a weekend?
That's not really feasible, is it?
Sounds kind of suspicious, doesn't it?
It does.
That sounds like somebody made a hell of a lot of money out of it, doesn't it?
$1.6 billion.
Yeah. And guess where all the assets were sold off to? Westpac Bank, who does all the government's banking again. And who, just after this incident, got a promotion, leaves the government, leaves his position, and then becomes the head of corporate banking for
Simon Power.
Justice Minister Simon Power. So, yeah, this was a big stinky one, and apparently the days before Alan Hubbard died, he'd said to the government, look, I've got enough evidence to say that John Key fudged this whole thing. Like, for example, you don't investigate a company just because the Prime Minister says they're dirty, right? You know, you actually have to do an investigation. There has to be evidence. None was actually gathered. In fact, the one of the main stated reasons why they did this, you know, thing was because somebody complained about not receiving a prospectus from one of the affiliate companies, a smaller finance company branches of South Canterbury Finance, which incidentally was totally private and didn't send any prospectuses.
It's quite a tangled web, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And the fact that Alan Hubbard died a day or two before he was going to go to court to release his evidence about John Key being a corrupt scumbag is even the more suspicious.
Yeah, yeah. You've got to be really careful about conspiracy theories, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think what's quite sad about this whole situation is that, from my summation, the Alan Hubbard was probably one of the few honest businessman left in the country with any real power, and because he trusted the government when they came in, because he trusted all these lawyers and everything like that, which never defended him one iota when he was under full-on attack,
right.
They were able to basically pilfer and take all of the wealth that he created. And you know, everybody from young farmers to elderly couples that have their nest egg in there lost everything. And the government bailed everybody out and then sold all the proceeds to companies, which they wound up getting jobs in.
That was one of the surprising things that came out of the debacle at the time, was that there were so many people in Southland that were actually supporting Hubbard and saying what a decent guy he was. And yet at the same time, the government was turning around and saying, oh, well, you know, somehow or other there's been a lot of money lost. But the whole thing was getting very vague and shadowy. But the thing that I remember all the time was how many people were coming out in support of John Howard and saying, you know, he's a decent guy and he's always done the best thing for us. So somehow or other, it all fell to pieces. So, yeah, I hadn't known all those facts. But it makes sense.
And also the accident was quite suspicious. He wasn't travelling at any speed at all at the time of the accident. In fact, Alan Hubbard and his wife had pulled over to the side of the road, and then they were hit by a car coming the other way in the wrong lane of traffic that was carrying a concrete mixer from Dunedin to Nelson and wasn't planning on laying any concrete.
All right.
And so Alan Hubbard went to Oamaru Hospital, where they said, oh, you're fine, you know, kind of thing. You know, you had a bit of a fractured pelvis or something like that, but otherwise he's good, you know, joking and laughing with the nurses. And then all of a sudden he's being wheeled out, and everybody's like, well, where's he going? Where's he going? They go, oh, we're taking him in the Westpac helicopter to Dunedin Hospital, you know, it's an emergency. And they're like, oh, okay, bye, Alan, bye, you know. It's a 6-minute trip in the helicopter, and he didn't survive it.
Well, that's a rather horrendous suggestion, isn't it?
Hmm.
I wasn't aware of that. I thought he was actually severely injured in the crash and died from his injuries in the crash.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't injured enough to not make the nurses laugh.
Oh, well, that's something I didn't know at all. It's a bit like good old Princess Diana, right?
Oh, yeah. I interviewed the guy who wrote the book, The Diana Inquest. In fact, he's up to part 5.
I didn't know anything about that Alan Hubbard thing. I just, this is the problem, is that you get such small snippets of information sometimes out of the media, and it's so corrupt and so disjointed. You've got to do the digging to start finding the truth.
You know, it costs you something to find the truth. It always does. Nobody ever finds the truth for free. That's what I've found. If you want to know the truth, it's going to cost you something. It might cost you money. It might cost you your job, or it might cost you your life.
There's a problem in the world, is that you do get these mysterious deaths every now and then. I didn't realize Alan Hubbard was in there as well. That's a bit of a revelation. But then what are you going to do in your life, eh? You just sit out your life doing twiddling your thumbs saying, oh, well, it's not my fault, it's not my problem, I won't do anything about it. it's a pretty sick sort of a life if you do that. But unfortunately, an awful lot of people do that. And this is why we're in the trouble we're in around the world, is because too many people take that view.
Yeah, it's just learned helplessness at the end of the day. People think that they can't accomplish anything, so they don't even bloody try.
That's right. And if only they knew that they could actually move mountains if they wanted to, it's actually quite easy. But they don't. The apathy is just almost 100%.
Yeah, well, that and the fear. You know, it's either I don't care or I'm too afraid to bother.
That's right. Fear comes into it a lot. You see, one of the things I used to study and try and explain to myself is how do you get 5,000 Jews to march out into a field, dig a hole, their own grave, and then stand by the edge of it and wait for it to be shot?
Fluoride probably helps.
What was that? Fluoride?
Yeah.
You reckon it rots the brain?
Oh, well, it is the main ingredient in Prozac and rat poison.
Oh, right. No, it's a big thing. I mean,
and it does eat through glass and concrete, so you know it can't be that good for you.
No, well, yeah, that's right. I mean, it's one of those debates. Where was it just recently? Was it Hamilton that just decided that they were?
Oh, we took it out and then we're going to put it back in. Why did you take it out? Well, a couple of activists got access to our council. And 7 of the councillors out of 14 recused themselves from actually even listening to the fluoride thing because they're biased.
Decision. There was a court decision just recently when the judge said that he saw no argument. There was no argument to be made that fluoridation was mass health treatment of the masses, because he compared it to using chlorine in water to sanitize the water, and he said that there's no argument to say that you can't use fluoride in water. The fluoride is a very strong element, and the arguments for it, I think, are it gets into your teeth and it hardens up your teeth and all that. The trouble is you're drinking the damn stuff, and it's going into your system first. And litres and litres and hundreds of litres, and over the course of a year, it's thousands of litres. It's in your cooking when you boil your spuds and all this, so you're drinking vast quantities of fluoride. I don't know the full argument with fluoride, but I certainly wouldn't, if they fluoridated the water that I drink here, I would immediately stop drinking the stuff. I don't see the evidence that it stops the tooth decay. We have,
if anything, it exacerbates it with dental fluorosis.
Well, I think so, and we don't know the full long-term effects on bones and the body. I mean, fluoridation has been around for a long time, but it hasn't been around long enough to make long-term studies on it. And I think it would be a dangerous practice to start doing that and say, yes, it's good for you. The thing is that we have wonderful toothpaste and toothbrushes and dental hygiene all over the place, and it strikes me as a bit bizarre that we can't actually brush our teeth and look after our teeth that way, that we have to actually drink tons of this stuff and put it into our bodies.
Now, speaking of which, fluoride's a toxic chemical and you can't dump it into the environment. But if you sell the toxic chemical, then it becomes classified legally as a product, not toxic waste. You can dump products into the human drinking water supply, but you can't dump toxic waste into it.
It is.
So what you've got to do is first you purchase your toxic waste, then you dump it.
Yep, it's a clever play on the legal side of things, isn't it?
We're a bit of freaking Alice in Wonderland, you know.
But you see, if people actually were intelligent and educated, they would be able to make some very educated decisions on what is basically a very simple subject. But the trouble is they can't. And we have to go through this annual debate, almost, on these petty little things that should be sorted out. But we don't. But you see, this is all smokescreen and mirrors, isn't it? While you're debating fluoride, you're not looking at Iraq and the Ukraine and Syria and Libya and all the rest of it. You're not looking at the real values and problems in the world. And some of them are absolutely horrendous, what's going on around the world. And we pride ourselves in New Zealand, or we used to, of being a Christian country, following Christian beliefs. Well, nothing can be further from the truth. In fact, Helen Clark, one of the things I put in my book was that Helen Clark actually declared once, when she was our reigning boss, that New Zealand was no longer a Christian country. And while she was actually referring to the statistics of the fact, it was interesting in the rather flat way she said it, that she couldn't give a shit whether this country had Christian values or not. And of course, if you're a dictator and you're looking at the corporate leadership of your country, why should you give a shit? It doesn't matter. And that explains why when 500,000 New Zealanders leave this country, she also couldn't give a shit. And there was another interesting time in the latter years of their reign when we started off the year in this country in January with a monumental surge in murders. And there was something like two or three a week for the first few weeks. And one
Have
of
you ever noticed it's never the politicians?
No, I know. I always wondered that.
I got an answer for you, actually. Hey, you know why none of the bad guys get assassinated?
Why is that?
Because only a good guy would want to get him assassinated, and good guys don't assassinate people.
That's it. That's basically the problem. What we need is some...
Yeah, good guys need to start assassinating people, you know.
And you don't have to shoot many. You've only got to shoot a dozen or two, and then the whole system will collapse.
Yeah, I mean, politicians and dictators and stuff like that, in order to kill good people, they kill millions of them and stuff like that. In order to kill bad people, it's just a few here, a few there, you know, boom, you know, problem solved, you're living in a gravy train.
I was talking to a Canadian a few years ago, and he actually came out with a very good quote. He said, do you know, if you got rid of government for a week, you could actually solve a lot of problems?
Well, the Queen still retains the power to dissolve Parliament. And I thought, man, that'd be a great power to have, you know, just
Yeah, but
dissolve them all, and sulfuric acid preferably.
I don't think that will actually work.
You reckon?
You've got to get these people to stand still, and they're too busy running around.
I don't know, just it's like a trap, you know, like in Jumanji or something, you know, you have some kind of a pit of acid, you know, cut over with leaves or something like that, and chase the politicians, you know, dress up in red communist outfits or something like that, and sing Viva la Revolution or some crap, and they would, like, run away from you going, oh, I need to save my scumbaggery ass from revolutionaries, and then they, like, fall in the vat of acid, and it's just, you know, boom, our problems evaporate.
It's a nice thought. What's your opinion of our man in the late evening, Paul Henry?
I haven't listened to his new show, to be honest. I've since my radio broke in my car and the television aerials got switched over to digital, I haven't really paid any attention to mainstream media whatsoever.
Oh, well, you haven't missed anything. You haven't missed a thing.
I didn't think so.
No, no. I was just wondering what you thought about him after his dismissal from TVNZ and then his dismissal from Australia, and he comes back here and he has...
People still keep giving the motherfracker a job, though, because the people love him.
Yeah, well, I wonder about that, because you have to go by the statistics and the ratings and all this, which are all produced by the media and the government anyway, so the reality was that they were saying he was doing all right here, and then, of course, he wasn't, and they sent him over to Australia, and the Australians very quickly made their decision on him and sent him back. And, of course, we go and report in the newspaper here saying, oh, isn't it wonderful to have Paul Henry back in this country, his wit and enthusiasm and all this. And so you get all these idiot writers who write these idiot profiles in the newspaper, and, of course, there are people out there that actually believe it, but it is just a paid article that's just been put in there to convince people that Paul Henry is actually doing a good job. But again, that's all part of the propaganda and the brainwashing of this country.
Well, as we all know, biased in journalism sells more magazines.
That's right. That's right. It's truly astonishing, isn't it? Do you know, when I sent out my book on the corruption of the New Zealand Law Society, and I sent it off to John Campbell and 60 Minutes and 2020 and Fair Go and Listener Magazine, and even sent it off to North and South and what's his name, Ian Wishart, and none of them got back to me. Not a single one of them. Mm. So it was interesting.
Yeah. Well, I can understand Ian not doing that, because he's always exposing scumbaggery and that, and he's probably working on his new books. He's working on a book like a year or something like that, sometimes even two.
Oh, yeah. But where's his credibility these days?
Ian Wishart's credibility?
Yep.
Well, he just released this new book, Totalitaria, which actually outlines the entire apparatus of the New World Order and how it's corrupting the media, government, and business interests in order to act together in collusion whilst having their own motivations, kind of like a shark attack. You know?
Yeah, I know, but don't you think we've got hundreds of books like that all over the world, and nobody pays attention to any of them, so why write another book?
Well, I don't think anybody from New Zealand's written one like that, you know? You never know. It might just be the ticket.
I don't think so. I think it'll just be another book.
Well, they did get on Coast to Coast AM as a result of it, with 29 million listeners.
Yeah, and then what was the result of that? Have we changed the system? Are we? Do we still have MMP? Is John Key still a manipulating financier?
Well, when you judge success, there's an awful lot of things that you've got to take into account. For example, how exactly do you measure the success? Do you measure the success by the amount of sales of the book? For example, one person bought 10 copies off of Ian just so he could hand them out because he thought it was so good. I'd say that's a pretty awesome book if somebody would do that.
Well, okay, so you've sold a few books, but
then there's one measure.
Ultimately, the goal is to change the system and to make people wake up, and what has it done? Has it actually done anything?
Can you measure the response? I mean, how many people have read the book? Do we know the numbers on that? No. How many people have taken action in their own life as a result of reading the book? Can we have a look at the stats on that? No, because these kind of things aren't taking into account the fact that it's almost unpredictable, right? Like one kid today who's, I don't know, like 14 years old or something like that, steals Totalitaria off his dad's mantelpiece and reads it. and then in 10 years' time, or something like that, he winds up starting a new political party to expose the scumbaggery of the New World Order or something. You know, like, the ripples are small at first, but you just watch how they grow. You never know. It's better than not doing anything.
No, you know, I agree wholeheartedly with you there. You have to watch the ripples grow, and as you say, if you don't do anything, then nothing will be done. But there are there's a prolific amount of books like that on the market in the system, and... maybe I'm sort of flogging a dead horse in saying it's going to have no effect, because as you say, you know, you throw a stone in a pond and the ripples will spread. And I know that for a fact with the books that I've produced, because although nobody will talk to me about it, if you look at the media reports and certain aspects of the legal system, the political system, it has had an effect, but they just won't admit it. But there were changes. For example, I made a comment in the book I produced last year called A Dialogue of Madness, and it's all about New Zealand politics and 9/11 and corruption and the lies of the government. I made a comment in there that the New Zealand Law Commission was looking to amalgamate the two facets of media complaints authorities. I can't remember the names now, but there were two of them. One was for audio and one was for visual. And Mary Major, who was a CEO of the system, she made a comment that she didn't want amalgamation. She wanted to keep the two separate. And her comment was that once you have scrambled eggs, you can't go back to yolks and whites. And I thought that was quite an outspoken argument, a good criticism. So I used it in the book, and I pointed out to the readers of the book that the New Zealand Law Commission quite actively shies away from the fact that it doesn't find any problem with the fact that we have two systems governing law practitioner conduct. And one is the courts, and one is the New Zealand Law Society's own system of disciplinary action, which is designed specifically to look after lawyers. So I wrote that in the book, and then I sent off several hundred copies around the country. And would you believe it, a few weeks later in our local paper, there was an article there that the Law Commission had abandoned its ideas of merging the media complaints authorities. They were going to leave them as they were. So you get little things like that in the paper that say that somebody must have read the book somewhere, but they won't admit it. So, yes, it is the stone in the pond with the ripples. You get lots of little things like that. And there was an article in the paper today, actually, just a small article, saying that there's a number of mayors around the country have suddenly decided to come out against amalgamation of councils because they saw absolutely no worthwhile profit in it. And there never is, because it's all about rape. It's all about taking ratepayers' money. You amalgamate councils and you just give them the people at the top a better ability to take
rape. I've decided to rename them rapes, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's all we're doing, you know. We're not ratepayers, we're ratepayers. We're just paying to be raped.
Yes, that's right. And so that's the way the system works. Every avenue, every aspect, there are people at the financial top end of the pyramid who are looking at our society and just deciding every single way that they can screw the dollar out of people. And amalgamation of councils is one of them, of course. MMP is another one, because you can completely and totally control government with MMP. You don't have democracy anymore with MMP. You have total control of government. There was something else. What was I going to say? I forgot. It just slipped out of my brain. Oh, that's another one. The books and publishing houses. I mentioned about publishing houses before, about how all the small publishing houses have all gone. And you only have big publishing houses now, and they totally control books. Well, there's another way they control books, because when I was driving around the country with my wife selling our books, we started going around to the libraries in Taranaki and Waikato and others. And the libraries were very enthusiastic. They bought some of our books. And then we went up to Auckland. And I went to one area in Auckland, might have been Mount Albert, I think. And we went to the library there, and the lady says, oh no, we're not allowed to buy books from independent authors anymore. And I said, oh, why is that? And she said, oh, I don't know, she says, but we've been told to you have to approach your central library in Auckland City. So I thought, oh, well, maybe this might be a one-off. So we went to another library in another location, and they said exactly the same thing. And then we went to a third one, and they said the same thing. So I thought, oh, well, there's no point in going to the other 55 or so libraries in Auckland. We'll go straight to the central library in Auckland. And so we went there, and they said, oh, yes, our new policy is that we are only allowed to buy books from book distributing companies. And I said, well, who are they? And they said, oh, people like Wheelers. And I said, oh, how do I get in touch with them? And so they gave me the address, and I thought, well, this is a bit off, you know. There are 55 or 56 libraries in Auckland, and I can't sell a single book to them. And, you know, there's 1.5 million people. So this guy that was telling us, he made it quite clear that the system had changed. So anyway, we went to Wheelers, and we found out that if Wheelers were going to buy our books. Now, Wheelers, book distributing companies, there are 3 or 4 or 5 major book distributing companies in New Zealand, and Wheelers are one of the big ones. Wheelers actually don't purchase books and store them per se. What they do is they wait for a library or somebody, a bookstore, to order them. So though you get a library in Auckland, like the Central Library in Auckland, they will say, okay, well, we need 10 books which don't have that one. So instead of going to the author and getting them off the author directly and cheaper, they go to Wheelers. Wheelers will immediately put 40% on the book, minimum, because that's what Wheelers told me. I had to drop my price 40% to sell my book to Wheelers, so then they could on-sell the book to Auckland City Council. They will also put another margin, their profitable margin, on the book. So the system of control of books is absolute now in this country, in that all libraries are being targeted, and high schools. They started working their way through the high schools as well, because we started going to some high schools, and they were saying the same thing. Well, we've been told we're not allowed to buy books anymore. We have to go through book distributing companies who control sales of books and put the price up. So we found this out to be quite a major problem, because after we had canvassed the whole of New Zealand, we did a lot of driving around, my wife and I, and we went from Kaitaia all the way down to Invercargill. And we actually cannot sell our books directly to libraries in Auckland, Hamilton, Tauranga, Wellington, Lower Hutt, Dunedin, and Christchurch. So about 3/4 of this country, the libraries of those cities will not buy my books from me. They will only purchase them through a book distributing company and pay a high price for it. And what that means is that the book distributing companies and the publishing houses now have total control of the sale of books. And the same applies.
That's freaky, man.
Yeah, I know, but this is the way the system works. And this is the truth. This is what goes on. I actually wrote to the mayors and the councillors of Auckland Council and Wellington Council, and there was one councillor in Auckland and one councillor in Wellington who actually wrote back to me, and they were quite disturbed by it. And then eventually I got letters from both of the mayors saying, we are looking into it, blah, blah, blah. And then a week or two later I got a request from the city libraries of both cities saying, we would like to purchase 6 or 8 or 10 of your books to service 1.5, 1.8 million people, only 20 books on cold. So basically what they were saying to me is, shut up and go away, we'll buy a few of your books and then go away. So although I have been down to Hukatika and put 3 of my books into Hukatika Library, and they were very enthusiastic people down there and very nice people, and then I went around to the high school, and the Hukatika High School also bought 3 of my books, and they were very... I've actually got 6 books in Hukatika and about 6 books in Wellington to service their libraries. Isn't that interesting?
It's when people say the word interesting, what I hear in my head is, that's freaking nuts!
Did you know that also in our country that prides itself on racial and sexual equality, that much... that 99% of all librarians in high schools and libraries in this country are female?
Did you say 99%?
99%. It is extremely rare, to come across a male librarian. In fact, in our travels from Kai Tai down to Invercargill, we probably came across about 5 men. And I think 2 of them were only stand-ins because the female librarian was away, sick or something like that.
Why aren't they trying to get the men out of the library, you reckon?
I'll leave you to answer. That one's a really interesting question. I'll leave you to answer that one.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of like in schools I've noticed as well, that very similar phenomenon, the feminizing of the teaching roles.
That's right.
And men, I think a lot of them shy away from particularly early childhood education because they get accused of sexual stuff. And there's no defense against those kind of accusations, and they wind up getting a black reputation and can't work anywhere. So, and they tell everybody else, and then everybody else goes, wow, that doesn't sound like the industry for me. So the men stay away, and there's nothing but women. So there's no male role models for the children to look up to. So that's, it'll unbalance everything. It'll make the women dominant, and it'll make the men feminine.
That's right, and that's exactly what's happening in this country. One of the local schools here, I was talking to the headmaster, and it was quite interesting because I walked into his office. I was talking to him about some other entirely irrelevant problem. And he said, you know, Ian, he says, I cannot hire male teachers. They're just not around. And now this was, admittedly, this was a few years ago. I don't know what it's like now, but a few years ago, he was in despair. He says, I cannot find male teachers. I've got a couple of female teachers that are leaving, and I cannot find male, because he said the majority of the teachers on my role here, he said, are female, and we cannot get male staff because there are none around. And they're none around for exactly what you just said. It's just like if you go into the Scout and the Cub movement and all the rest of it. And there was some advertising being done on television about 2 years, 3 years, maybe 4 years ago, almost pleading. It was quite an incredible advert on TV. It was almost pleading for men to put their hands up to become rugby coaches and football coaches. So then the boys had some male role models and some coaching. But as you say, all these men have been scared away because of the sexual attacks that have been made on them by the government and the media. It's died away a lot. But in the 1990s, it was quite horrendous. And there were men being accused of sexual harassment and rape and all sorts. And most of them were just purely fictitious. But men were having their reputations utterly destroyed, absolutely destroyed. There was no recovery from something like that. And the damage that was being done was so horrendous that I think even the government realized that, that they had to stop this persecution of men in these roles. And while there's certainly and obviously a problem of child molestation in this country, it is being handled horrendously by the government, by idiots, pure idiots, who think they know what they're doing and have absolutely no idea. But the damage has already been done, and the result of it is that there's a great paucity now of male teachers in our schools. And 99% of all librarians in New Zealand are women. There are no male influences anyway. Interesting.
Strange. And I think this whole male warrior spirit, you know, I think the New World Order figured out, you know, I think having people around that actually like fighting against oppression and scumbaggery might not be a very great idea. Let's wipe it out. Well, how do we do that? Oh, well, how about we get the CIA to finance feminism and the Rockefeller Foundation? Oh, that sounds like a brilliant idea. Oh, yeah, man, let's implement it.
Yep, that's what it's all about. Complete nutters.
You know, it's nutters based upon scumbaggery. It's like one lie leading to another, leading to another, leading to another, and you know what happens every time you catch a liar out in one lie? They have to tell 10 times as many lies as they've already told in order to lie the way out of the one lie you exposed.
That's it. John Key and John Banks know all about that.
God, I freaking hate Banksy. I hate John Key. I hate Banksy. Look, hate's not too strong a word, okay? People, I think, are just not in touch with their hate. They're not in touch with their rage. And in so doing, they're completely out of touch, okay? If some scumbag sells...
That's a really good statement, Vinny. I actually like that. They're not in touch with their rage. We need to have people who are willing to go out and smack somebody on the nose. And yes, okay, they'll be in court the next day and all the rest of it. We actually need to go back to this world where we actually take action like that. So the scumbags, as you call them, actually feel the pain of what they are doing. Because at the moment, they're immune to it. What they can do is that they run away. The politicians run away, the lawyers, the solicitors run away, the corporate leaders, you know, Fontaine, all these people run away. They can do it. Look at the Pike River mine, for goodness sake. In the 21st century, we blow up a mine and we kill dozens of miners. And look at the mess. It should never, ever have happened. You cannot have mine explosions like that in today's society. With all the technology and all the knowledge we have of safety in mines all around the world, over hundreds of years of mining, and we blow up a mine. That is a government problem. And the government has dealt with it exceptionally poorly.
The first police officer on the scene was really shocked that he wasn't the first person on the scene after the accident. You know who was?
No.
The New Zealand Army. Specifically, the New Zealand Army demolitions people.
Oh, really? Hmm. Well, that's a new one on me.
Yeah. And around the time, there was a big debate about whether or not they should have open cast mines and whether or not the ones where they're going underground and everything were a bit too dangerous because they wanted to open up all the national parks for mining. And guess what happened directly after this underground explosion? Ah, you know what? Maybe open cast mining isn't such a bad thing after all. Are you sure you're just saying that, Mr. Key? It's not because you got shares in Jackson Mining, is it? No, nothing to do with that. I'm not corrupt. I never accused you of being corrupt. Yeah, well, you were gonna.
You're full of interesting facts.
Oh, yeah. I retain bits and pieces here or there. Like, you know how the media's adept at coming up with sound bites that mean nothing?
Yep.
I'm adept at remembering sound bites that actually mean something. Unfortunately, sometimes they're out of context and don't actually make any sense, but they sound like they do.
That's one of the things about being a leader, actually, is having a very good memory, because to remember what these people have said over the years and throw it back in their faces, because they start to panic when that happens. Because they live on a daily basis of lies and bullshit. And they, as you say, you tell one lie, then you're going to have to tell another 10 on top of that. And they lose track of it. They have no memory, so they lose track of all the lies that they've said. And you can see their faces doing some phenomenal footwork.
Aerobics,
yeah. Yeah, it's just tremendous to see the muscles in their faces just dancing around like Swan Lake, you know. It's just incredible. While their brains are desperately trying to find an answer to the 10 lies that they've said. It's quite amusing at times.
Well, usually, and I think the Prime Minister is exemplary at this particular job, where he'll just start talking and rambling, not answer the question, and just keep talking and rambling. And when you say, but you have to get back to the question, he goes, next question.
Yep. No, he's been well-trained.
Like a dog, you know? Yep. Pavlov.
He has a very good team of support staff. It's not the government, and it's not the National Party. On the outside, he must have an extremely good support party who are doing a lot of research and telling him how to speak and what to say.
He must have people working overtime, you know, like up all night, you know, putting the P back into PR. Hey, incidentally, do you know what the best thing about being on P is?
What's that?
It's only six more sleeps till Christmas.
I wouldn't know. So what makes you get out of bed in the morning, Vinny?
The missus wakes me up.
Oh, that's handy.
More or less. There's frickin' cicadas outside, and we don't have blackout curtains either. What's a more interesting question is, what makes me stay up long into the night? Exposing scumbaggery. Editing. Yeah, uploading stuff. Yeah. We get like a 4 a.m. finish, or a 5 or a 6, or sometimes 8. I remember one time I stayed up 3 nights in a row and put together three documentaries in 3 nights edited. Just
that's not bad.
Yeah, it's freaking brutal is what it is. I think my bedtimes were like 5:20, 6:40, and then 11 a.m.
Right.
Over those 3 nights, you know. And that was because a couple of fluoride activists and another guy who's had his stuff on the North Shore, Russell Malcolm, the Pinchgate affair. I don't know if you've heard of that, but my God, does he have a story to tell about the corruption in the council? Last time he told a story about corruption in the council, he got the entire frickin' Rodney Council, including the mayor, fired after it got investigated by the government. And this time, instead of getting fired, the corrupt people had already fully taken over the council and the super city and totally phased his ass out.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Whenever I'm serving others, that's when I perform above what I normally think that I'm even capable of. Because it's like, who else is going to help these people? If not me.
This is the problem, and this is one of the issues today, is that this is one of the reasons that I wrote the book that I did on the corruption of the New Zealand legal system. While I was dealing specifically with one case and exposing these ignorant little people, the bigger, wider issue is that there are hundreds and thousands of people who are being ripped off by lawyers and solicitors every week, and they don't have the strength and the knowledge and the wherewithal to fight these people. They can't. And because the systems that the lawyers and the politicians have contrived are there to protect the lawyers and the politicians, these earthy, honest people that, you know, just simply get up today to work for their families and their children, their community, they can't do anything about it. They can't fight that kind of corruption and those sort of pieces of filth, I call them. They can't do it. So I wrote the book and distributed it, and I wrote it in such a way that while it knocked the lawyers very heavily, I had to write it so then most people could actually read it and understand it, so then they could get some value from it and try and to learn from it, and give them, and hopefully give them the strength to know that they can actually fight these pieces of filth.
Well, you just got to show people examples. I mean,
yeah.
I think it's like, have you ever heard of the Gordian Knot, Alexander the Great?
I have heard of it, yeah. I'm trying to remember what it's about.
All right, well, just quick rehash. It's about genius, this story. All right, there's a knot. It's called the Gordian Knot, and it's incidentally in a place called Gordium. All right, it's a knot made out of a rope. And it was said in legend and what have you that whoever was able to undo that knot, everybody would bow to them as king, and he'd be like the king of kings, you know, baddest ass you've ever seen. And so Alexander the Great comes up and he goes, so do you guys actually really believe that story, that if I undo this knot, that you'll all, you know, bow down to me as king? And they go, yeah. And he goes, all right then. He takes out his sword, cuts it in half, and he goes, all right, king now.
That's called lateral thinking.
Yeah, see? And that's why a lot of people don't get my jokes, is they go, oh, I don't get it. And I go, well, I'm a lateral thinker, you know, think about whatever's literal and then go to the left of it.
Yeah, we see, I mean, I've never met you in my life and I've never heard of you until a couple of weeks ago, but I understand what you're saying. The problem that we have in New Zealand and the problem that you have is the problem that Raywin and I found when we went to America is that people don't talk anymore. They have no ability to understand conversation. They have no ability to converse. So our language is being lost. The use of words, the understanding of words, the double entendres. You make a joke and some people don't get it, but other people will. There was a time when I was in the Merchant Navy. You develop such a rapport with the people that you're working with month after month that you can start laughing over the same thing and nobody's actually said a word. And that is what real society and real community is all about. I sat in a mess room once. We all came up at 10 o'clock in the morning. We sat in this mess room and we were all staring at each other because after about 4 months of telling each other the same jokes, we'd run out of things to say. And then this little Welsh guy, he came in and sat next to me, and he just sat back in his chair and banged his head against the wall. And I just thought that was incredibly funny. And he did. but he didn't say anything. And then after 30 seconds, he just looked at me and just yelled at me to shut up, and he, with a big smile on his face, and he got up and left. And nobody else at the time could understand what was going on, but the pair of us, you know, we were so close as workmates, we understood. And I hadn't said anything, but he knew I was laughing at him, and I knew he was laughing at me. The communities that we have today, the societies we have today, nobody talks to each other. And so
I would operatively ask the question, what community, Ian?
Well, this is right. We don't have a community anymore. This is why the government wants to amalgamate everything. They want to take away communities, regional authorities. They want to take away your local post office, your local bank, your local hairdresser, everything. They it's all amalgamated, and you answer to the massa in the big house. We're all slaves to the system now, and you're dead right. There is no community. There's no society. There's no spirit.
It's been annihilated by television.
It has. Television and computer games and Skype and what's the other one? Facebook and Twitter.
See, now the only time you can actually have a conversation with somebody is if you're having a conversation about a conversation you had on Skype.
Yes, this is it. I was listening to, what's his name, a guy I'd never heard of before. He was introduced to me just a few weeks ago, a guy called London. He's a singer-songwriter here in New Zealand. He's absolutely brilliant. He's one of the best singer-songwriters I've heard in a very, very long time. And one of his songs is about dumbing down people, and his lyrics are tremendous. And there's another one where, in that dumbing down, I think, is it that one? Yeah, it is. It's in that song, Dumbing Down, where he went to work and everybody's laughing. And when he asked what they're laughing about, it's because they saw on Facebook how somebody had put a secret camera in somebody else's toilet. And that is the level of intellect and intelligence we're at today with Facebook and with our corporations, our governments, MMP, and our law society. It's dumbing down people to the point where you actually find it funny to hear about a secret camera in somebody else's toilet. How much lower can we get? Well, the answer is that we can get even lower than that. We can go out and we can murder children in this country.
I've come to a thing like goodness. There's no limits to good and there's no limits to evil. However, they both define themselves by the opposite thing. Goodness defines itself by having an abundance of restraint, what it will prevent itself, what it will not allow itself to do.
That's a good definition.
And evil is the direct opposite. It defines itself from what it will not restrain itself from doing.
Correct. That's a very good definition. Very, very good definition. The Germans summed it up. I'm not sure which one it was, if it was Himmler or Goebbels, to do with the murdering of the Jews. And he said it somewhere along the lines of, you know, you kill one Jew and there's an outrage. You kill 100 Jews and there's a fuss. You keep on killing Jews and you end up killing 5 million and nobody gives a shit. And this is the way that society works, and this is the way that evil works.
I believe that was a Stalin quote, actually. It was
a Stalin quote. I can't remember, but I know it was a...
It goes something like this. When you kill one, it is a tragedy. But when you kill 10 million, it is a statistic.
That's it. That's the dead right. People can't grasp the enormity and the inhumanity of that. It's like they cannot grasp the inhumanity of what America did with 9/11 and the Twin Towers. What's your opinion on that before I go further?
I believe there's a hell of a lot of scumbaggery involved, and the craziest conspiracy theory that came out of the day was nine virtually unarmed people were capable of getting NORAD to stand down by a guy directed in from a cave with a laptop who was already dead, according to the CIA.
Well, when the Twin Towers came down, like everybody else, I just looked at it in just absolute horror. And, you know, you watch it for week after week and month after month. But at the back of my mind all the time, there was something niggling at my brain, and I couldn't figure out what it was. But a few years ago, 6-7 years ago, I was actually looking at it on television and saw the plane hit. And it just struck me then that it's actually impossible to bring one of those towers down by flying a plane into it. It just can't be done. Those towers are built out of solid steel, the construction of the steel framework of the buildings. And those little planes, when they hit, as you will well remember, when they hit, they just disappeared as the planes just fell to bits as they hit the...
It was like a pencil going through a mosquito screen. Which was incidentally what the architects said a plane would do to the overall structure of the building.
That's how they were built. The architects and the engineers that built it, that's what they designed it for an aircraft hitting it, full fuel and all the rest of it. Now, the Washington government, of course, will tell you that it was the fire and the heat from the flames and the fuel. Well, if you remember when those planes hit the buildings, there was a monumental fireball on the opposite side. 90% of the fuel would have been atomized and just exploded in a big fireball. So you had about 10% left in the building. Now, that's only a few hundred.
And every single floor was completely lined with fireproof asbestos.
Yeah.
And the year before...
The thing is with steel as well, is if you try and heat up steel, it will try and get rid of that heat as fast as you're putting it into it. It's very, very difficult to for steel to lose its structural strength by heating it up. You've got to heat it up to 500, 600, 700 degrees centigrade, and that means a sustained blast of heat. You don't get that from a little carbon fire and a bit of petrol. It's actually impossible. As an engineer, I can state quite categorically, without any word of fear or making an ass of myself, you cannot bring one of those buildings down by flying a plane into it, let alone two of them.
Let alone three of them.
And this is the other thing that nobody will talk about, is that third building came down like a brick shit house. It just fell down. And the government won't talk about that. And, but they will say that, it came down because of damage from the other buildings, that sort of thing. Well, it's all bullshit. And so there's no question in my mind about what happened. Those buildings were professionally destroyed. The other thing is that in 1945, if you care to Google it and look at the history books, you'll find that in 1945, a B-25 twin-engine American bomber actually flew into the side of the Empire State Building. And, of course, all the crew were killed. I think one or two people in the building were killed. And there was a big fire in the building, and the local New York firemen went up there and they put the fire out in 40 minutes. And the crash occurred on a Saturday, and the entire building was open for business on the Monday. So there was no worries about structural strength or the building falling down or anything like that. So it proves that even in 1945, 55 years before the Twin Towers, that you could fly a plane into a building and not bring it down. But in 2001, two buildings were brought down by two little plastic tinny airplanes. The whole thing was a setup. Now, for all the conspiracy theories in the world and for all of the arguments that can be made about all sorts of things, the one thing that people should focus on entirely and exclusively is that the American government blew up the Twin Towers and used it as an excuse to invade Iraq and Afghanistan. And they blamed it on a terrorist activity.
Well, actually, it was not just an excuse to invade countries, it was also an excuse to invade everybody's privacy.
That's it. It was the opening of the door to the word terrorism, anti-terrorism, homeland security, the entire shebang. It is a gross and obscene, inhuman act that they did. And the world needs to wake up to that. And the world has. I mean, there's an awful lot of people that know this. There's numerous people, hundreds, thousands of people around the world that are speaking out about it, especially all the architects and engineers, because if you're an engineer or an architect, you look at that and immediately you say professionally, that can't happen, full stop, end of story.
Ironically, my uncle's an architect, and he got really, really angry and started slamming the desk and stuff. And those buildings were destroyed by planes, the cognitive dissonance, the inability to even use your own training and your own skills that you've brought up your entire life is not enough to make you accept that the government will kill its own citizens its own means and ends.
That's one of the big... what can you say? It's one of the big pluses of why the Americans thought they could get away with it, is that there will be people that just simply refuse. I mean, my mind refused to think that. And it never even crossed my mind when I first saw it happen. It's just not possible. You just wouldn't conceive that that could have been a contrived business. But it wasn't until later that I began to think about it. And it was after we toured through the state and had seen the state of America and realized that this was a country in dire straits. And then I came home to New Zealand, and I was watching a documentary thing about it, and it just suddenly dawned on me in a great big flash of light, as it were, you just can't do that. You cannot bring one of those buildings down by flying a plane into it. It just can't be done. And then, so if you actually look at video footage, you can actually see the detonations of the demolition charges going off as the building comes down, floor by floor by floor.
Yeah. See, previously I'd never think the government would do anything bad or whatever, and now I just assume, like, I remember, and I've said this on the radio a number of times, I was coming in home after a day's work, and my wife shouts out to me, "Hey, Vinny, did you hear about this truck bomb that they found in Times Square?" And I go, "Oh, don't worry about it, baby, it's probably just the FBI," and it was.
I know, I'm exactly the same. It doesn't matter what goes on around the world now. The first thing I'm thinking is which government and whose government is actually behind setting that up, because it is a setup.
Yeah. I mean, I treat the government the same way the Saudi Arabians treat the Israelis, you know. It doesn't matter if a water pipe breaks in Damascus or something like that. It's an Israeli plot.
Yeah, that's the way it works. And they're quite right. I mean, the terrorism that we suffer from today is not from terrorists. It's from our own homegrown governments.
Well, in fact, interestingly, if you look up the definition of terrorism in the dictionary, Ian, you'll find that terrorism is actually a system of government whereby the government threatens and terrorizes its population in order to getting them to do what it wants.
Yeah, that sounds like... I didn't realize that. That's a dictionary view, is it?
Yep.
Well, you see, you don't have to take it one step further and say, well, if the Americans brought down the Twin Towers, which they did, and they then invaded two sovereign states, Iraq and Afghanistan, you then have to look at our own government and say, well, why did we support America and England and send our own soldiers over there to support terrorism that was homegrown terrorism?
Yeah.
Because that's what our government has done.
Well, I guess it's probably because of the same criminal scumbaggery cabal that controls the United States, also controls New Zealand, and controls the world. So, you know, everybody has the same playbook. The exact same system exists everywhere. It's just the accents are different, or the insignias on their uniforms might be a little bit different, or something of that nature. But it's all the same kettle of shite.
It is.
You know, and it's good, though. I mean, just like I don't know, have you tried Goody Goody Gumdrops before? The ice cream, you know?
Yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah. Not many people do. I like it because it's kind of like digging, you know, through this mountains of bubblegum-flavoured crap in order to find the nice little juicy nuggets of sugary goodness in there that are the gumdrops within the goody-goody. And I think that's not entirely dissimilar from how I choose to socialise, you know? You're just going to pile through there's just mountains of shit out there. Shit, for fuck's sake, get that out of the way.
You've got to sort it all out.
It's unbelievable. You know, it's like I saw an episode of Futurama, and they had these brain slugs that would infect people, like they'd attach onto your head and just sit there and just suck off your brain energy. And one of the crew, his one died. And it goes, what happened to it? And he goes, the poor little guy starved to death. Because the guy it was attached to was too frickin' stupid to have any neural energy for it to feed off. And that's entirely how I see myself to a degree. It's just so a giant brain slug that's just starving to death amidst all this stupidity.
It's it. There's an awful lot of people that they commit suicide over it. They see absolutely no focus, no reason to live in this world because... they know the absolute bullshit and the shit that surrounds them.
They have no reason to live because they think that the living have no reason.
Yep. It's a tragedy, really, and there's a lot of good people that have walked away from this planet because of it.
Yeah. Well, I figure it like gold mining, you know, how you're panhandling.
Yep.
There's all this dirt and all this sand and grit and everything like that you got to pick up in your hand, and you just keep shaking it and shaking it and shaking it, and eventually there's enough gold there to make a living off, right?
Yeah,
I think that's how I look at it in terms of friends and social contact and what have you, and I'm very grateful that I haven't forgotten that those pieces of gold are still there amidst the dirt, if only you would dig them out and seek them out and not try and stay at home and avoid it all.
You're full of good things to say there, Vinny. You remind me of that American guy that does that dirty jobs on TV. He went round to interview these people that were The hunters in America would take their ducks and their geese and their swans to them, and they would pluck the feathers off them. And this old lady had been doing this job for decades, most of her life, and every time she opened her mouth, she had a saying. She had a piece of wisdom to say. And after about 5 minutes, the guy that does the dirty jobs there, he said, you know, you could make a T-shirt industry out of you because of the number of good things that you've got to say. And you remind me of her.
Oh, well, thank you. Incidentally, most of my friends are much older than I am too, and they're full of wisdom, which they impart to me, and I forget about half of it.
Ah, well, you're bound to. You're only human.
Yeah, well, you know, I haven't earned any of the knowledge that they've accumulated over their longer lives that I've had and stuff like that, and it's like, I don't know.
Well, you're not doing too badly.
I could be worse.
You could be worse.
Yeah. I certainly don't see anybody else giving all the activists in this freaking country the airtime that they deserve in order to express all their ideas in their fullness and amazing variety than I do. You know, I mean, point a stick. Tell me if there is one. They don't freaking exist.
It's extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Difficult.
So, on that note, this has actually been the first 3-hour show I've done without actually even taking a break, and I was so encapsulated by our conversation here.
No, it's been very good, Vinny. I appreciate it, and I appreciate you contacting me. I've enjoyed the conversation myself as well.
Did I say encapsulated by the conversation? I meant captivated.
Well, both are appropriate.
Yeah. All right. And so what we're going to do now is just give a quick plug, ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoyed this conversation, if you'd like to see more of them and what have you, then please, for the love of Norwegian cheese, go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and donate or subscribe for a couple of dollars a month if you're capable of affording it. And there's a proviso on that. I don't want to see anybody ever do this. Do not donate to me unless you've got all your bills paid. All right, I'm talking about you're going to have the kids fed, you got to have your rent and the power and everything. You got to be totally above water if you want to donate to the show. I'm sick and tired of all these poor-ass, broke-ass activists telling me, oh, Vinny, I can't give you anything. Are you kidding me, bro? You expose scumbaggery. You don't get paid. You don't even get any donations out of it, okay? Just keep doing what you're doing, all right? I'm doing what I'm doing for a very specific purpose. Because nobody else in this freaking country is doing it. That's really the only reason. Because it needs to be done. And out of moral obligation, I've given up my entire life. I wanted to be a film director. I wanted to make millions. And by lords, I could have. But I chose to expose scumbaggery instead. I chose to help all those people that are exposing scumbaggery when I can't do it myself. You know, give them a little bit of the coverage they deserve. And that way, every single time that somebody gets contacted by some douchebag media reporter, it's not like, oh, another person who's going to try and frickin' set me up! So, yes, thank you. Ian and Raymond, Pacman, can be found at stonesofakron.com. That's stonesofakron, akron.com. Ian, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Vinny. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com is where you can donate or subscribe to help keep this operation going. Hope you don't let me down. Thank you very much.